STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. Thank you for joining me today. Looking forward to chatting with you as you call in and you and I can talk about anything that's on your mind, the area of ethics, values, and religion. We're going to kick this show off, though, with a little chat with an old buddy of mine who just dropped in out of the sky. Rodney Lake just flew in, what, an hour and a half ago, 2 hours ago from New Zealand?
That's right, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. 13 hours in the air.
Yeah. So I'm feeling a bit like a zombie.
You look a bit like a zombie, Rodney. Oh, my goodness.
I probably smell like one, too, which
you're fine.
Good in this small room.
No, you're okay in that regard, fortunately, because, yeah, we do have a small studio. But the last time that you and I actually connected was, I can't believe it's been 4 years now.
That's right, yeah.
And you were visiting, and you hung out in the other studio while we did a show there before we had the studio here at Stand to Reason's office. And then you went back, having visited, I think, just about every significant apologetics organization in the country at the time.
That's right.
And you had already launched your own enterprise, is that right,
yeah,
at that time? And but it was kind of fledgling.
That's right.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that organization is called Thinking Matters, Equip, Encourage, and Engage. Tell us a little bit about the organization, Rodney, and what's been happening in the last 4 years with your enterprise.
Yeah, sure. Well, Thinking Matters is, I guess, the equivalent of Stand to Reason in New Zealand. We want to see the church taking apologetics more seriously, and we're wanting to see apologetics have an impact on, mm-hmm, on both believers and on their effort to reach out in, mm-hmm, our culture.
Mm-hmm. What is your do you have an overall vision, a statement, mission that kind of captures it, or is it basically what you just told us?
Yeah, I guess it's really about networking together all of the different people and the ministries out there that have something to do with apologetics or, mm-hmm, worldview,
mm-hmm,
so that we're not fragmented. We're working, mm-hmm, together. We know what each other is doing, mm-hmm, and we support each other.
Well, we had a goal when we started 21 years ago to not reinvent the wheel and try to link arms with all the other organizations or individuals that we felt were kindred spirit, and that was a tremendous help, because now we have this great brotherhood in the States of like-minded people that are all moving towards the same goal. Have you been able, is something like that going on in New Zealand? I know that right here in the States, of course, the last 20 years have been a renaissance,
yeah,
in Christian thinking. What about New Zealand right now?
Yeah, I think we're following the same, the similar sort of trend. There are more and more people coming out of the woodwork who are passionate about what apologetics can do.
Uh-huh.
And it's the third wave that you speak about.
Yeah.
Thinking Matters is about bringing together those,
right,
who are in that third wave, who are actually doing the groundwork in the church.
Right, right. Boots on the ground, so to speak.
That's right.
You have a little flyer here on Thinking Matters, and you have four different purposes you listed: train believers, build conviction, encourage Christians, and engage worldviews, and transform culture. Tell us a little bit about those things and how those these goals are actually playing out in New Zealand culture, because I think your culture is probably a lot more secularized than ours, and maybe you can say a bit about that. But tell us about your activities, the specific things you're doing.
Yeah, New Zealand is very similar, I suppose, to European culture. If you're going to compare it to, mm-hmm, to the US culture, we have a very secular environment. We have a very low church attendance. The church has been sidelined in all public policy. Mm-hmm. We've just had an election, and pretty much all of the leaders have made a claim to atheism of some sort, and some of them even pantheism when it comes to God.
You know,
so
nobody in the States, no politician could probably, and I'm just as an observation, could actually claim to be an atheist and never
right.
get elected.
I mean,
that's as secular as we are. That's still considered, an unpardonable sin probably by most Americans. So, but you have your MPs, your PM, your prime minister, members of parliament, routinely profess atheism.
That's right. And during the election, it was just considered normal when they were given the God question that they would just shrug their shoulders and say, "No, I don't believe in God or a higher power of any sort."
So, you know, Rodney, when I was
not all of them, of course, there are conservative parties mm-hmm. there that have a Christian, an overtly Christian worldview, but mm-hmm. But for the majority, the big parties, mm-hmm. They are very secular.
When I was there the first time, I was working with, trying to remember the enterprise, and I'll think of it in just a minute.
That would be Compass.
Compass, yeah, exactly.
I just had dinner with Greg Fleming the other
night. Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, he passes his regards on
to you.
Oh,
well, that was great. We had dinner with Greg here a number of years ago by the airport. My wife and I took him to our favorite restaurant, which is Houston's, and it was a great outing. And Greg was a main player in that enterprise when I was first there. But here's what stood out for me. Well, for one, was just taking Compass as an example, a very vigorous group of Christian thinkers who were willing to engage the society and, in fact, wanted to transform their culture for Christ. And when I first heard that, I thought it was a bit cheeky. And then I realized there's only 5 million people in the whole country, And so it's a lot more doable than in the States. But it's still, you're swimming up upstream, so to speak. But at one point during the Compass 2-week enterprise that we had, and this would have been 9 years ago now, because almost 10 years ago, because my first daughter had just been born, and this was in January, which is your summer break, mm-hmm. and so Annabeth was born in December. So at some point, the group sang your national anthem.
That's right.
And all the words are, I didn't know it, but all the words were up there on the screen. And your entire national anthem is a prayer.
It's a hymn. That's right. It's the only national anthem in the world that is actually a Christian hymn.
It's unbelievable, especially in light of the fact that this is something that people must sing on a regular basis out of fealty to their nation in a patriotic manner, but they can't possibly mean the words they're singing.
No. And, of course, you do get some fringe elements who want to dump it and replace it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it was such a stunner, though, to see that there was, even in your country, you had this, what appears to be a powerful conservative Christian influence in the founding of your country.
That's right. I mean, we have a very strong Christian heritage in our history, and it saddens us to see that it slipped away so much.
So what's happening with the church in New Zealand?
The church is oh, gosh, it's such a complicated question. The church is growing in some areas. It's very Pentecostal. There was quite a Pentecostal mm-hmm. Movement back in the 60s and 70s, mm-hmm. which has got a lot of hangover still. So mm-hmm. there are a lot of churches which are very very focused on the emotional, on the I really struggle to say anti-intellectualism because it's quite a harsh thing to say, but there is an anti-intellectualism that is quite prevalent in New Zealand.
Yeah, and we have something similar in the States. And look, I went to a Pentecostal church for 25 years, Foursquare denomination, so I have no personal hostilities there. But I think it is fair to say that as a cross-section in American culture, the Pentecostal churches are more subjective, feeling-oriented than they, and therefore, as a result, are probably less responsive as a group to the kinds of things that Standard Reason is going to offer. I think that's a charitable way of kind of characterizing it.
And that's certainly true in New Zealand. It's almost as though they see apologetics and worldview training as a luxury. They think it's something that would be nice to have, but we've got so many other things. We've got marriages breaking up. We've got people with addictions. There's all sorts of things that pastors are getting their hands dirty with every day. And when it comes to apologetics, they go, love what you're doing, fantastic, go for it, but I'm too busy to do anything.
Well,
and they just see it as a luxury, which is a real shame.
Yeah, it is a shame because it's not a luxury. It's an essential. However, it's hard not to be sympathetic to the challenges that pastors all over the place, your country and ours, mine, are facing, and they just seem so overwhelmed. This is how this is why at Stand to Reason we have always tried to posture genuinely as a help to pastors. We're here to help you. We're here to do maybe some of the work that you aren't able to do because you're overwhelmed. Give us a shot. Give us some time, and also, we find that in so many churches, I wouldn't say every single one, because I haven't been in every single one. But I think in most churches, there are people of kindred spirit that would like to grow in the life of the mind and certainly understand the reasons why our convictions are sound.
Yeah.
And that if we can find that dry tinder and strike a spark to it, then that can set something going on a grassroots level in that local church that can actually help the pastor.
And that's exactly the strategy that we take. We want to support churches. We don't want to tell them how to do their job. So we have strategic resources that we promote quite heavily.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is your own Tactics in Defending the Faith, the mm-hmm. DVD series. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the book is a part of that as well. But the DVD series, it's plug and play.
Mm-hmm.
You start up a small group.
Make the coffee.
Yeah.
Push the button. Huh?
So in 6 weeks, you've gone through that material, and it's fantastic material. We also promote Focus on the Family's material, The Truth Project,
uh-huh.
which is actually starting to get a little old now, but it's still very powerful.
Right.
It's really good material, and every time people go through it, they say, man, that was good. That was
really
good.
Yeah, well, for a lot of these people, they've never been exposed to any clear characterization of a defense for truth.
Mm-hmm.
Been around for, what, 10, 12 years, maybe more.
The Truth Project.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. I'd guess it was 6, 7, 8 years old now. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Maybe not as long as I thought, but still. And they've produced other things since then. But these are the kind of things that can really make it a difference in a local church.
Mm.
Talking with Rodney Lake here, my buddy from New Zealand. Thinking Matters is his organization, and we actually sent a team.
Yeah.
A couple years ago.
Yeah.
To visit you and do some work with you. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, Brett Kunkel and of course your Amy Hall. Amy Hall who does wonderful work for your blog,
mm-hmm.
and also Jay Watts, who works for Life Training Institute,
which is
Scott Klusendorf's offshoot that came out of Stand to Reason.
Jay's kind of a grandson to us in a certain sense.
He's a fun guy too.
He's fabulous. He's a sensational speaker, and he's a great guy to hang out with, too, just like the others as well.
Yeah. So we had all three of them down, and we went on a speaking tour, and boy, did I work them hard.
You sure did.
I had Brett working within a couple of hours of landing after that 13-hour flight.
He was already speaking. I don't feel bad about putting you on the air here while you're still jet lagged, Rodney. So, and then Amy did some sessions
She did, and she did really well, too.
Well, so
we're really pleased.
And
we videoed some of those, and so we've got those on DVD, so mm-hmm. those are still having an impact today. Mm-hmm. So we really appreciate it.
Well, we're glad that we could help out, you know, and we, just like we were talking about earlier, we like to hook arms with people of kindred spirit and make common cause on these things. And if we can expand our influence indirectly by encouraging you and what you're doing in New Zealand, we're thrilled to do that. You know, I just had another thought here, and I'm thinking about your pastors, the great bulk of them, apparently, the Christian pastors in New Zealand, thinking that apologetics is a luxury. And what you just described to me about the political situation, you have what formerly was a very Christian nation, and I mean here just that they were Christians who were central to the founding enterprise, and it was the Christian faith that was the informing faith
of the
enterprise, much like
Absolutely.
We have had here in the States.
Very similar. Yeah.
And your national anthem is a Christian hymn, yet your politicians openly declare and proudly declare their atheism.
Yeah.
What better indication or more significant indication could there be that something like apologetics is not a luxury?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when a whole nation slips through the fingers of the church, how does that happen? And there's probably a number of different causes, and you know, but certainly it seems to me that in our case and in your case, the church fares much better when there is a thoughtful defense
Absolutely.
For the faith that's being given. Do you feel that you're getting resistance from Christian circles, or are they patting you on the back, but sorry, we can't all participate, we're glad
for
you?
No, that's the thing. They are actually very enthusiastic about what mm-hmm. we're doing. It just doesn't follow through with action, with funds, with staffing or anything. They're always saying, fantastic, love what you're doing. I can see it's needed, but it just doesn't follow through. There's still a disconnect there.
Now, you have a couple of things going on. I'm looking at some of your flyers here or things that you're doing. You have a thing called Iron Sharpening Iron. Tell us about Tactical Teams, Iron Sharpening Iron. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, that's where we have some young apologists who are at university who are wanting to have opportunities to engage. Mm-hmm. So they're young, they're passionate, they're wanting to use their apologetics, and we're placing them into, at the moment it's just Christian high schools. Mm-hmm. It would be very difficult to get them into secular schools, but mm-hmm. in Christian high schools, we're putting them in front of senior high school students. And so it's young people addressing young people, mm-hmm. And it's win-win because the high school students are getting to ask their hard questions to their peers, and they're mm-hmm. getting some answers. And, of course, these young university students are getting to practice and engage with an audience that's not exactly sophisticated. Their questions aren't going to be really tough, but they're going to be tough enough. So
right,
it's a win-win. And so we're partnering with these Christian mm-hmm. high schools, and they're very enthusiastic because mm-hmm. they recognize the need for our young people to have an opportunity to ask the hard questions mm-hmm. and have them answered by people who have actually studied these issues.
You know, Rodney, you made a comment a moment ago about how it would be impossible to get into state high schools and stuff. You mentioned a similarity between New Zealand and Europe, and I think this is where there's a difference because they do still have state churches in Europe and in the UK and on the continent. And so, you know, there is not a intellectual openness so much to the gospel, but at least there isn't that kind of hindrance. But Christian training of any kind, is it more like in the States where they have this alleged separation of church and state, or at least the way it's played out, which means that the church can't be involved at all in the state enterprises? That's the way it's viewed. Is that the way they understand it?
It's similar. What's interesting is we actually haven't gone as far as the US in that. We still have a group called Bible in Schools, and they do actually go into secular schools and do Bible. Now the lessons are outside of school hours. So they have to be at lunchtime or after hours, but they are allowed to. But there is there's quite a groundswell of resistance against that, and there's an organisation. Forgotten the name, but they're trying to get them removed. They're trying to actually enshrine in law that they can't do that. Huh. So,
well, what's your plans here for the next few? You're going to be here for a few weeks again?
Yeah, I'm here for 3 weeks, traveling around, visiting the likes of Biola, Houston Baptist, Discovery Institute, Reasons to Believe. There's a few really interesting.
Sure.
Southern Evangelical Seminary in the
Well,
the
that's coast to coast there.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, and Houston Baptist wasn't around as an apologetics enterprise when you were here last time. They've got a growing program there. Yeah. And
spending time with the Russia Christi, they've got a symposium in 3 weeks, and that's going to be really interesting.
There's another group that, since you've been here, really has blossomed
work,
and
yeah.
flourished.
Yeah,
I think they've got something like 100 campuses now. It's kind of like, for people not familiar with Ratio Christi, think a kind of like a campus crusade for Christ, apologetics oriented, not so much, you know, evangelism for laws, but apologetics. So it's an organization that's there on campuses with full-time people who are training other Christians to
do
a defense of the faith. So
we've got a lot to learn from them. I'm really looking forward to spending time and just seeing what they do and how they do it.
Well, you're a good learner, Rodney. You take what we've been doing here and then you bring it over to New Zealand, and that gives us a chance, not just us stand to reason, but all of us as part of the brotherhood or the fraternity of Christian thinkers in the States to have an impact down under in New Zealand.
And
so
it's an exciting time to live because, you know, there's never been a time in history when the material that we work with is so accessible. There's so much of it out there. There's so many great speakers. There's so much content online.
And the scholarship is so good.
Yeah, yeah.
It seems like everything that comes down the pike nowadays, even though it sounds persuasive or convincing to people who aren't thinking hard about it, these are softballs that we knock right out of the park.
Yeah.
I don't mean me necessarily. I mean the team.
Yeah.
And the team is great. So you're right. It's a great time to be involved in the kingdom work, and I'm glad you're doing it in New Zealand.
Thank you.
Rodney, good to have you on board.
Thanks very much. Great.
Rodney Lake and Thinking Matters. I didn't get a website.
Thinkingmatters.org.nz.
Of course. Thinkingmatters.org.nz,
I should
NZ
say.
NZ as in New Zealand,
case
you couldn't decipher that accent. Yeah. All right, friends, let's take a break. I'll come back with your calls in just a moment on Stand to Reason.
Have you been on a college campus lately? The intellectual and moral challenges awaiting our youth are immense. Are the students in your home, church, or youth group prepared for what lies ahead? Most Christian students are ill-prepared for an aggressive secular campus and culture. It's time to step up the training of our young people, and Stand to Reason will help you do just that. Join us this fall for our two-day Rethink Student Apologetics Conference. In September, we'll be in Orange County, California, to equip your students with a reason for the hope they have in Jesus. Go to RethinkApologetics.com and register today.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to iDonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit iDonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
All right, friends, that was great talking to Rodney Lake. And just a quick postscript on that. Rodney told me that they're actually looking for an intern to come work with them, somebody who can raise their support and come to New Zealand. I know suffering for the Lord in New Zealand is really hard. It's just like a terrible place to live, and the scenery is really ugly, and there's nothing to do there, you know. But if you want to suffer in Middle Earth, check them out at thinkingmatters.org.nz, as in New Zealand. And that will be your route to contact Rodney. He's going to be stateside for a few weeks here, but send an email, contact him. He probably has some contact anyway while he's gone. And again, they're looking for an intern to work together with them on the kinds of things that they're putting together in New Zealand. So a second thing that he mentioned to me off the air is he said, you know, I wanted to communicate a warning. Because what's happened in New Zealand, and give me a nod if I get this right here, Rodney, see on the other side of the glass, is happening now in the States. It's just New Zealand is further down the line, the secularization of culture. They have now universal or countrywide same-sex marriage. They have outlawed spanking, outlawed it. They have, what was the other thing he said? Abortion, of course, is legal, but they, legalized prostitution, abortion is legal, and they want to extend kind of the concept to 40 days after birth for disabled children. Did I get that wrong? Euthanasia, though, infanticide? Oh, okay, full-term abortion. Sorry, I misunderstood that. Anyway, it's not a good picture. But it's exactly what you would expect for a country that has abandoned its foundational principles that are Christian and openly asserts atheism, and then it's anybody's game. They're just living out their atheism. But now it's become a matter of public policy. And therefore, Christians in that country have to live under those policies because Christians have given up. That is, they haven't been around informing the policy, making a difference on the society and the culture. I don't mean they've totally given up. There are people who are Christians obviously involved in government. But as a church, the church has failed to have its influence. And it might be. Who knows? It certainly makes sense to me that when you ignore the thoughtful issues, the reasons why you believe, it becomes harder and harder to have that kind of influence in the culture. Just something to think about. All right, let's go to your calls. And in Buffalo, New York, Aaron, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hey, thanks, Greg. I'll get right to it because I only have like one bar left on my signal here, and I'm not sure if I'll be like going in and out.
Okay.
So I just finished watching the movie Her by Spike Lee, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with the premise of the movie.
I'm not.
Okay, it's about a guy who it's in the future, and he kind of falls in love with his operating system.
Remember reading about this. Okay, he falls in love with his OS, and...
And the main plot of the movie is not a big deal, but it brought up a conversation with me and my wife about this sort of idea about self-aware computers and in the future. And I've never heard a Christian I respect give me their opinion on sort of what a Christian's perspective on this sort of technology would be. Now, as a dualist, you know, I do find it hard to believe that technology would ever advance to a stage where a computer would truly be, you know, self-aware or conscious.
Yeah.
But I do think that it's possible that in the future, or maybe the near future, computers get to a point where it becomes very difficult to tell if they really are conscious or if they're just very good at pretending
right,
to be
right.
conscious.
Yeah, there's a reason they call it artificial intelligence. It's because it's artificial. It's
yeah,
not the real
so
thing, you know.
That gets to my point of, so we would put the label on it as artificial. And a lot of these movies, like let's say Transformers or movies like AI, artificial intelligence,
right. mm-hmm.
Where everyone in the movie is so sure that these life forms are in fact only artificially alive.
Uh-huh.
And kind of come to realize that at some point, something happens and sparks a sort of true consciousness within these sort of entities.
Okay.
And I guess, you know, there we were toying with ideas, my wife and I, of whether God sort of has the ability to endow such an entity with a soul at some point. I think that obviously is kind of crazy idea, and it's way out there.
Uh-huh.
But I'm talking about, you know, situations where computers, like I said, it becomes difficult to tell. They act as if they're humans. They act as if they have a true free will. And, you know, you see movies where they're forcing these robots to engage in hand-to-hand combat against their quote-unquote will.
Yeah.
But it could be just as easy as your computer maybe 30 years from now asking you at the end of the day, please don't turn me off.
Okay. Let me offer some thoughts about this. Okay. And here's the first thing. I mean, it keeps bouncing into my head here. I've got something more substantive, but I just want to remind you and the viewers, you're talking about movies. You
yeah.
could do anything in a movie. I remember seeing a cartoon when I was a kid, and some critter was trying to chase some other critter, and the chasee went up into the tree, and the chaser couldn't get it because it was in the tree. And then he does a kind of an audience pan and says, hey, this is the movies. And then he just walks through the air right up to the tree. You know, we can do anything in the movies, you know. And the same thing is true here. You can write all kinds of things into scripts. That doesn't mean that the things are even possible, much less, I should say plausible, much less possible. Can a machine, well, you asked the question about whether God has the ability to endow a machine with a soul, the answer to that is, of course, he does. But we have no reason to believe that he will do that. You also use the phrase that the machines act as if they were conscious, and certainly sometimes they can do that. I mean, I've got a phone that talks to me. I push the button and I say something, and then the phone talks back to me and gives me information. All right. It's acting as if it's conscious, but it's not because it's a machine. Okay. I mentioned the phrase artificial intelligence. That's why they call it artificial. And then it's interesting what you said. I'm not finding fault here. I'm just pressing on the words because the words are important here. Well, we label it artificial. And my response is we're not labeling it artificial. We are describing it as it is. When a machine displays the appearance of intelligence, it is an artificial intelligence because it is not really the function of an intelligent, conscious mind. It is simply zeros and ones in operation, following the design or following the, the design of its programmer. That's all. So it's artificial. Consciousness is the kind of thing that cannot arise spontaneously from matter. So no manipulation of machine parts is ever going to cause consciousness to jump into existence, because consciousness is not reducible to anything physical. Now, this is speaking as a dualist, but it isn't the dualist doctrine. It is the dualist conclusion. That's why it's the dualist doctrine. It's a reflection on the nature of consciousness and the nature of matter. And this is why materialists have had a massive struggle trying to account for consciousness given a materialistic worldview. So much so that now world-class philosopher Thomas Nagel has written a book called Mind and Cosmos, in which the subtitle is Why the Materialist Darwinian View of the Universe is Almost Certainly False. And one of his main arguments is the nature of consciousness is irreducible to matter. And if it's irreducible to matter, then it is not even in principle explainable by any Darwinian mechanism. The world, writ large, is bigger than the material elements that are part of it. That's his point. Now, he's not a theist, but he understands the problem of consciousness. And so when I deny that a machine will ever be conscious, it's not based on theological presuppositions. It's based on understanding of the nature of consciousness itself, and understanding that even formerly materialistic atheists like Nagel have had to come to grips with. So I in Hollywood you could do whatever you want, and you're going to have all kinds of machines that in Hollywood are conscious because it's Hollywood. But in the actual world, machines aren't conscious, in virtue of some kind of material makeup. Consciousness has a different source. And even if they were conscious, Aaron, it wouldn't follow from that we would have unique moral obligations to them, because the world is filled with other conscious creatures, other than human beings, to whom we have, it seems to me, virtually no moral obligations. Every sentient creature is conscious. It has a soul of some sort, because souls are the seats of consciousness. It is the locus of the first person perspective, and the nature of the soul itself is immaterial. It can't be reduced to anything material. And so, if all sentient creatures have souls, consciousness that signals the existence of the soul for that creature, and we do not have moral obligations towards all those sentient creatures, then having a sentience, consciousness, or even a soul does not in itself imply moral obligations towards that.
So I guess that I do take that sort of line that it's very hard for me to believe. I wouldn't say it's impossible for me to believe that, because I'm a dualist, that a machine could ever get to that point with sort of advancements in sort of biotechnology and fusions of biotechnology, and I do kind of largely agree we don't have obligations to just anything that is sentient. I guess my issue would be the difference when you combine sentience with sort of intelligence. So a rabbit has got it's got an animal like soul, and some people would say, well, but they'll either say it doesn't have a human soul or it doesn't have a spirit.
But looks like we lost you there. You're cutting out there a little bit, Aaron. Let me respond to what you've said here. Soul and spirit are basically the same things biblically. Sometimes distinctions could be made between them, but in terms of the substance, they're the same. They're the immaterial self. I don't know why biotechnology makes a difference in this discussion about something that can be developed to the point that they are conscious, because this implies that consciousness is a result of a sophisticated molecular organization. Whether the molecular organization is biologically active or not is irrelevant to the question. Consciousness is not a result of sophisticated organization of molecules such that maybe someday we'll get sophisticated enough to put it all together just so consciousness will spring into existence. It is unrelated to molecular organization. There is not the one bit shred of evidence that there's any relationship to molecular organization. That is, you get a certain organization, you get a little bit of consciousness, you get more sophisticated organization, you get more consciousness. They are two separate realms, completely separate realms, consciousness and matter. And that's really the heart of my argument from a secular perspective. That is, I'm not even trading on biblical statements. I'm not trading on theology or anything like that at this particular point. I'm just simply saying that consciousness has nothing to do with material structures, such that if you get the structure just right in your kind of erector set, all of a sudden consciousness springs into existence in the immaterial realm and somehow attaches itself to that molecular structure. It just those are worlds apart, quite literally. You're still there. Okay, go ahead, Aaron. We're almost.
Your objection, I know I'm breaking up, so this is the last thing I'll say. Okay. Your objection to, say, forcing two robots that do not want to fight, forcing them to fight and gathering around to watch them fight would be wrong, not because they're conscious or not. It would be wrong. Why would that be wrong?
It wouldn't be wrong. What you said is that they do not want to fight. There is no such thing except for in science fiction. That presumes that they have a will they can express, and wills are functions of consciousness, and machines aren't conscious.
So if they express such a will, we could do away with it and say it doesn't. We don't have to worry about that.
Well, no, see. Okay, now you've brought in a counterfactual. If they express such a will and they can't because consciousness is not tied to matter in that way. So, you know, even if they did express such a will, that doesn't by itself mean that we have a moral obligation to accede to its wishes. Do you have a dog? A cat?
I do.
Yeah, well, you see, we make our animal pets do things they don't want to do. And they're undeniably conscious. Okay, so the fact, and again, what you have to be careful of is imagining counterfactuals, like things that are contrary to fact in the future. Well, if it did, well, if I had wheels, would I be a trolley car? Somebody once said, you know, if my daughter could fly, would she go to Europe? Well, she can't fly, and she'll never be able to fly. So in a way, we're still talking science fiction. It doesn't turn out to be. It gives too much credibility to the possibility that machines can become conscious. I'll tell you why people think machines can become conscious, because they think human beings are merely machines that are conscious. That's why.
Okay.
And the evidence that there is the evidence and the increasing realization that consciousness cannot be reduced to something physical is forcing us to adjust our worldview away from materialism. But that's what materialism demands, and that's why people will think, well, in the future we'll have machines that become conscious because we were just machines that got evolved to a certain point where we became conscious. That's their view. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, the other is inevitable. And then when it's depicted in films, then it looks really plausible, but it's not. So I thank you, Aaron, for the call. It was a good, stimulating discussion. I hope you take some things back to your wife on this and see what she comes up with. Let's go to break on Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kokel.
You can find STR on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians. Want to know what is going on with STR? Speaking events, new podcasts, resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find all of our social media connections at str.org.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org. Or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
All right, friends, Greg Kokel here, one of the good guys, equipping you to think every week. I used to say Sundays because for 25 years, that's when I broadcast. Now, the live show is actually Tuesday nights from 4 until 7, and you can dial up 855-243-9975 and catch the show. And that's, of course, you can call in then and ask questions, give a comment, take exception, whatever you'd like. That's what we're about. And if you... if you only get a single hour on the weekend, best thing to do is to podcast the show. You can do that at str.org, or you can do that at iTunes, of course. Melinda just gave me a heads up that I'd actually written a piece that's on our website that deals with machines and consciousness, and the title of the piece is When the Enterprise Got a Soul. When the Enterprise Got a Soul. There was an episode of Star Trek in which that was the case, and question came up. I actually don't remember so much what I wrote about that, but you can check it out on the website, and it's apropos at least to this discussion, When the Enterprise Got a Soul. And if you're on Twitter, you can follow the dialogue there. Melinda's got a link, and of course, as per usual, Amy Hall will be posting the links of everything that we talk about on the blog following the show. That'd be the Wednesday blog. Okay, let's go to Spencer. And Spencer, I can't pronounce the name of the camp that you're at.
Camp Lejeune.
Lejeune, all right. Where's that at?
It's in North Carolina.
Oh, okay, great. Good to have you on board, Spencer.
Good to be on board.
Thank you.
Anyways, I'm calling because recently we had a discussion in a Bible study that I lead about a very hot topic issue, obviously Calvinism and Arminianism. And someone brought up that this isn't at our church, but there's a church very nearby us that in their statement of faith, they actually state that they adhere to Reformed theology.
Uh-huh.
But because of this, they don't evangelize at all. They don't advertise for their church at all. They say, basically, if you're elect, you'll get saved and you'll come to church. and if you're not elect, then you're not going to come to church and there's
right.
nothing we can do for you.
Yeah, well.
And anyways, someone in the class brought I'm not calling a campaign for one view or the other. Just someone in the class brought up this as a challenge against Calvinism, and although I've studied it quite a bit, I've never really heard a Calvinist directly respond to this. And since I know you are a Calvinist, I'd like to hear how you respond.
Well, look, the simple answer is God is going to use the means that He's designed to save those that He wants, and that church will not be one of them. That isn't going to change anybody's salvation. The curious thing about this, though, is that our case for sovereign grace is made in the New Testament by people like Jesus, Paul, John, etc. All right. Yet these same individuals who are the doctrinal foundation for the case for sovereign grace themselves did not make this application of the doctrine, because God ordains not just the ends, but also the means to the ends. All right. And I,
so
what this church is doing is disobeying the Lord in this regard. They may believe in sovereign grace, but they're not believing in the other things that the New Testament teaches about the means by which God accomplishes his sovereign purposes through, you know, in the church. And the best illustration I could think of to make this point is in the book of Genesis, where Abraham is promised a son the next year. All right. Now, this is going to be an act of God. God promises this, right?
Right.
Now, did Abraham, do you think he was tempted to think, wow, can't wait, I'm going to see what God does with Sarai, virgin, not exactly a virgin birth, but because since God promised it, I don't have to do anything. This bed's not going to creak. God's promised it. I can sit by and do nothing. No, that didn't happen. He understood that there were means to certain ends, and this is why I think Sarai said, as she overheard this conversation, shall I have, she laughed like this is a ridiculous thought, and I think she said something like, shall I have pleasure again? Okay,
okay.
So the idea is she understood that sex was involved. He understood that sex was involved, regardless of the fact that God promised an offspring. All right?
All right.
So again, this is back to means and ends. If the church wants to be a biblical church and they think that the New Testament teaches sovereign grace, then they ought to teach sovereign grace. But they ought to teach the other things that the New Testament teaches along with sovereign grace, and that is the means that God has purposed for grace to be dispensed, and that is the evangelism, the preaching of the gospel, and the church undergoing evangelism and discipleship. And, you know, I don't know what else to say than that.
Okay.
They're not living consistently with the text at that point.
Okay, and I would agree. I guess what someone in my Bible study brought up, and he's not a Calvinist, I guess he, although he kind of agreed with how this church viewed it, and he said that it seems that evangelism or apologetics, any kind of defending of Christianity, would, in the same way that a strict determinist would say free will is a useful fiction, he said, wouldn't it be the case that trying to argue for Christianity anyway is also ultimately just a fiction because the elect are going to get saved and non-elect are
no,
not,
I don't think so. And this is where, and it's hard to describe this, but except for to say that the New Testament holds these things in perfect tension.
Okay.
Think about Paul. Now, I was reading this the other day. I think it's Acts maybe 16 or thereabouts. And Paul is in Corinth, and he's frightened. Paul is frightened in Corinth. How do I know? Because he has an appearance by Jesus. And Jesus says to Paul, and I'm trying to find it right now, see if I can get the exact thing, but I'll give you the summary of it. Jesus says to Paul, don't be afraid any longer, for I have many people in this city. In other words, go and speak boldly. Don't be afraid, speak boldly, because I have many people in this city. Now, why couldn't Paul say, well, wait a minute, you what? You have many people in this city? Boy, am I glad to hear that, because it's really scary out there, and if they're yours, go get them, because you don't need me, obviously. You got them. You've elected them. You know who they are. They're yours. I'm taking a vacation.
All right.
No, it is because Jesus had many people in those cities that Paul was enjoined to go out and speak to them. Do you see that?
Oh, yes, I do.
If that rationale that is being offered or suggested by your Christian friends is a sound rationale, then Jesus was out of line when he was talking to Peter rather to Paul in this. But let me just see right here. Concluding. No, that's 16. I'm still looking for the reference because well, I can't find it. Maybe over the break I'll take a look at it. But
okay.
One reason that I thought was one reason it stood out for me is that Paul was actually frightened. Paul was frightened. Okay. And mm-hmm. I thought, wow, gee, I relate. He's just like me. But never mind. Jesus said, "Don't be afraid. Go out." And he also said, "I'll protect you." And it turned out, I remember reading that the ones who got beaten up after that was not Paul, but somebody else. So God was protecting one Christian, but not necessarily protecting the other. I can't find it. I'm paging through this. But it's Acts 15, 16, 17, 18, somewhere around in there. But but there you have Jesus in a vision to Paul making a statement that just captures both of them. I have many people in this city, therefore don't be afraid. Go get them. And that's basically the directive. How are we to go get them? By speaking the gospel and defending the faith. Both are commanded in Scripture. Both are the things that God uses. Both are the things that we're supposed to do.
All right.
All righty?
All right. Well, makes sense. Just like I said, I wanted to hear how you'd respond to that. So
all right, Spencer. Thanks a lot for the call.
All right. You're welcome.
Okay.
You.
Yeah, let's go to Mike in LaGrange, Georgia. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mike. Hi, Bob.
You're Mike, I'm Greg.
I was listening to a podcast just a couple weeks ago, and somebody else would be.
That's right. It happens with regularity. I've heard it on other shows, too. You're fine. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Greg, it's great to talk with you. And Melinda just informed me that you're going to be in my neighborhood tomorrow night, and that's really cool.
Oh, that's right. Okay. I'm going to be flying out to Atlanta.
Atlanta, and I'm about an hour away from there. So okay. I just confirmed with my wife that I think we have a date.
Super.
Tomorrow night. So,
all right. Look forward
to seeing
you. Let
me give you just a little concise background before you ask my actual question. But
okay.
It's something it's been on my mind for a while, and I've been thinking, you know, I had a call in to stand to reason and see what Greg thinks about this.
All
and
right.
Just the other day, I was listening to a podcast of a sermon by John MacArthur, and he was speaking about fellowship in the church and pointed out that fellowship is intended to be done in person. And that the one of the things that he was talking about beyond that was that with all our gadgets today that are, you know, whether it's an iPhone or, you know, sitting at a computer or whatever, in effect, in a lot of ways, causes isolation, even among Christians who think they're connected, but they're maybe not really.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sermon, he referenced an author of a book that I just picked up the other day, and I found it very fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
The title of the book is Amazing Ourselves to Death.
Oh,
and it's something I would commend to you to consider. Even the it was written in 1985, but the author's son actually wrote an updated introduction, I think, back in 2006.
Did you say amazing or amusing?
Amusing.
Yes,
amusing,
that's right. It's amusing. I know this. I know this. I know this title.
And so I'm finding the book very fascinating, and it connects with the question I've kind of been wondering to myself, and the question is, what are the implications of the mode of communication used in the enterprise of apologetics and as Christians attempt to engage with the culture? For instance, you know, there's verbal, there's text, meaning, you know, the old style of text, like a book, like a Bible,
mm-hmm.
versus video and the sound bite and then one-way communication versus a dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to get my mind around that to figure out what we have to be most considerate of in the age of being totally connected but totally disconnected from people.
Yeah, well, I mean, a couple things are going through my mind. Just got a couple minutes before the top of the hour. But one thing that comes to mind is the famous saying by Yogi Berra, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. And the application for that witticism here is, or malaprop, is that there are multiple means of communication that are available to us, more than they were available in the first century. But notice the different means of communication that were used in the first century. There was individual conversation. There was public preaching, that is open-air preaching. There was preaching within the group, like at the church. There was writing. That's why we have the Gospels, for example. The accounts were written down. They were memorized. They were recited. There were creeds that we see in the New Testament. These are tightly focused statements of doctrine that are put in a memorable fashion. All of those seem to be things, and all of the things that might be in play were in play, it seems. Styles.
Okay.
And I think that the same thing is true today. We have many medium. We're using an advanced medium now, radio,
certainly,
through an internet. Nothing wrong with that, and so does John MacArthur. However, there is a liability, I think, especially now, that if everything can be done digitally, then we do isolate ourselves in ways that are not healthy nor appropriate. Because the body of Christ is meant to be a body. It's not meant to be a morgue where you have bits and pieces of body parts scattered around.
Or perhaps a cyborg.
a what? A cyborg. Well, see, even
a cyborg
is unified.
Right.
I'm thinking about just take a hand, cut up a human body and spread it all around. Then there you've got the parts of the body that are isolated. Well, when they're isolated, they don't do much good. And if our body of Christ is isolated and just digitally connected, then it probably is not functioning the way God actually intended the body to function. In fact, it isn't functioning the way God intended, because there are a host of things that are standard parts of being in the body of Christ that seem to require much more intimate involvement.
Right.
Than just digital involvement. And so I do think that culture is getting fractured. They say we're connected. We're really connected. No, we're disconnected. I mean, it's like the old joke about, not so old, I guess it's a new joke, but two people on a date, but they're not talking. They're sitting across from each other, texting each other.
Texting back and forth, yeah.
There you go. So, and I think MacArthur, if that's his point, he's got a good one. And we have to be careful of that. So there's my music, though, Mike. Something to chew on for you. Thanks for the call. All right. That's it for this hour of Stand to Reason. We got more to go. Hope you stay with us. Hello, my friends. Greg Kokel here. Stand to Reason is the show. And let's see what I got here this hour. Some people are getting in the queue here to chat with me. And, of course, that's what we do here. We talk about the most important things of life. Ethics, values, and religion, my goal, stand to reason. My goal is to stand to reason for classical Christianity and classical Christian values. And I have said for a long time, since I started radio, actually, before Stand to Reason started, I started in 1990 in radio, that I wanted to have a role, essentially, and to raise up a whole army of clear-thinking Christians. And it's fabulous to see how so much of that has been happening in the last 20 years, not just through my efforts, Stand to Reason's efforts, but something the Holy Spirit is doing all around the world, but especially here in the United States, a renaissance of sorts of Christian thinking. And it's a good thing, too, because things are getting harder. Two things are happening right now that make this, in my own life, that makes this next piece of news information, I think, poignant for me. One of them is that I've been working on, I'm recasting our vision for the next 10 years. So 2015 to 2025, what are we doing? What are we after? And I'm not going to go into it right now. I'll bring you up to date soon when I've got it all together and our staff. We were talking about it and some, we're not going to change anything foundational, but we are going to aggressively try to address the next, not just this generation, but the next generation, bringing up the next generation of ambassadors for Christ. But part of the discussion, though, entails our commitment to send out a warning and a kind of a call to action for the church. And the culture is getting increasingly secularized, and I want to add aggressively secularized, and we need to be able to respond to the challenge that the culture is giving. So that's one thing in my mind. And also, I just finished the November Solid Ground yesterday, and in that Solid Ground, I talk about the line in the sand that has been drawn for followers of Christ. And how, again, it is important that out of fidelity to Christ, when the culture draws a line in the sand that has to do with some doctrinal or ethical issue and says to us, come on over to our side, join us, celebrate diversity, and we will like you, but if you do not, we will punish you. That we do not have the liberty as followers, just focus on that word, followers of Christ, to follow the world. We have to follow Christ. We can't step across that line. Now, that line is getting more deeply drawn. There are multiple lines in the sand now. Some of them seem theologically inconsequential, but I argue in the Solid Ground that they are strategically significant, especially as they relate to the line in the sand that is theologically significant and central, and that is Jesus of Nazareth, the way, the truth, and the life. And so we are entering a 10-year period where we are going to be sounding the alarm more. We are going to call to action, but then train not only this generation, but also offer training for the next generation to stand on our side, to draw our own line in the sand called faithfulness and truth, and beckon the others, the adversaries, if you will, to come over to our side, to God's side, on this issue. So these are the things that are kind of happening. Now, this current event issue I want to talk about now is just another example of that trend. And Amy Hall from Stand to Reason actually wrote about this two or three weeks ago in the blog. I think it was probably maybe 2 weeks ago today or something like that, because she gave me the material when it was current. And I wanted to talk about it on the show, and other things got in the way, so it's been a couple of weeks. But if you go back two or three weeks, and she'll probably make reference to it tomorrow on the blog, Melinda's, I'm sure, tweeting on it at the moment, you'll see her piece, where'd that come from? her purse. You'll see her piece on the Cal State University's derecognition of the InterVarsity clubs. Now, InterVarsity is a campus organization that is a Christian organization that is meant to build Christians up on campus and meant to advance Christian purposes, goals, the gospel, discipleship, things like that. And, of course, InterVarsity is like a lot of other organizations recognized by the campus and, therefore, as a recognized group, is able to receive the same kind of funding that everybody else receives. And access to facilities, promotional stuff, money. Well, about, 2 years ago now, the chancellor of the California State University system issued a new policy that requires recognized student groups to accept all students as potential leaders. Now, that sounds harmless at first until you think about it. Wait a minute. That means when InterVarsity, a student group, nominates its new officers to lead the student Christian group, it must, according to this policy, give equal consideration to atheists as potential leaders for the Christian group. Now, to say no to atheists is a type of discrimination in the circumstance. Yes. The question is it illicit? And the answer is, of course it is not. Because this isn't just I'm even trying to think of the best way to describe it. This isn't just a slam at atheists, like, we're not going to include you. This is the leadership of a Christian group. And a person who is an atheist does not qualify to lead a Christian group. Is this not obvious? And if they were forced to allow atheists to lead the Christian group, then the Christian group would likely go out of existence. What this dictate does essentially is it erases the distinctiveness of the group itself. Now, as Amy has put it here, this means clubs no longer have free access to campus meeting rooms. That is, clubs that don't fulfill this requirement then are disenfranchised from the group. No access to campus meeting rooms, nor can they receive student activity money, participate in student fairs, or use the university name in the name of their clubs. Whether anyone truly thinks it's reasonable or not, Amy writes, this strategy has already been used to derecognize Christian campus groups in other parts of the country. By the way, I'm not sure... I'd be interested to find out, is this kind of universal? Do Christians then have to be allowed to run for the atheist club? Can they be a part of the atheist club even though they're Christians, even though their whole purpose of life is contrary to the purpose of the group? Anyway, InterVarsity has issued a response. Here it says, our chapter leaders are required to affirm the InterVarsity's doctrinal basis. This new Cal State University policy does not allow us to require that our leaders be Christian. It is essentially asking InterVarsity chapters to change the core of their identity, which is true, and to change the way they operate in order to be an officially recognized student group. The statement continues, while we applaud inclusivity, we believe that faith-based communities like ours can only be led by people who clearly affirm historic Christian doctrine. No duh. That's not in the statement. That's my editorializing. It continues, the policy affects 23 chapters within the California State University system. The policy exempts sororities and fraternities from gender discrimination. Did you hear that? The policy exempts sororities and fraternities from gender discrimination. Why? That's discrimination, right? Because it makes sense in that kind of organization. That's why. The statement continues, we believe there should be a similar provision for creedal communities. And then offers for more details, see Colleges and Evangelicals Collide on Bias Policy. These are links. And the New College Thought Police, which I think is an appropriate title. Now, in August 2013, the new chancellor, Timothy White, graciously granted religious groups a one-year exemption for the 2013-14 school year. Of course, now they're in the new school year, so now the policy is put into place. But the CSU chancellor's office says that no further exemption can be made. Thus, all 23 university chapters on CSU campuses now I operate without the benefits of official recognition. Now, look, it may turn out that this is the way things are going. Have to go, I guess. They are the way they're going. And gone. This is what happens when secularism becomes a religion and it gets and runs rampant. The stupidity of this ruling here by the CSU, Cal State University chancellor. And even though it's entirely legitimate to make exemption for creedal communities just like sororities and fraternities, it's not being done. And it's not hard to imagine why, but I don't want to be a crybaby here and fuss about these things. I'm just making the observation, look, this is happening. And it may be that we have to, that this is a fait accompli, this is over with, and at least in the state of California, though it seems to be happening in other places too, and this is the way we have to function under this liability. Okay, we will endure, the gospel will go forward, that's all right. Christians around the world are suffering a lot more than we are in this regard. But it's fair for us to say, wait a minute, this isn't right. It's just not right. It's not sound. It's not reasonable. I understand what the thinking is here. And the thinking is, well, you guys are discriminating. And my answer is, of course, we are discriminating. Just like sororities and fraternities are discriminating when they do not allow members of the opposite sex to be part of their enterprise. Is that a discrimination? Sure. So this is a discrimination that is licit, that is appropriate, that fits the facts, that is common sense. But make no mistake about it, there is no way to get around the discrimination charge. There is no way. Because if InterVarsity is axed, essentially, because of its discrimination, the axing of InterVarsity is an act of discrimination. Somebody gets discriminated against here. The question is, which discrimination is reasonable? The same thing happened with the Boy Scouts, homosexuals, that whole thing. I don't have to revisit that. You all know about it. The poor Boy Scouts were demonized because they were discriminating. So what was the response of all these left-leaning groups to kick the Boy Scouts out? Was that an act of discrimination? Of course. You cannot avoid... Look, to be a discriminating person, in one sense of the use of the word, used to be a good thing. That is that a person that was discriminating in that sense could make appropriate distinctions, morally legitimate distinctions between things that were so much unalike with regards to the issue in question that there was no need to group them together. You discriminated between them. Now the word itself is a pariah, and all somebody has to do is yell discrimination, and you're going to be in big trouble. Never mind that the punishment for discrimination is always an act of discrimination. Yeah, you guessed it. And the same thing is happening here. Looking here again at Amy's article, I think she's citing the article now, The Wrong Kind of Christian, in Christianity Today magazine. Let's see, who is this? Anyway, the article says it didn't matter to them if we were politically or racially diverse, if we cared about the environment or built habitat homes. It didn't matter if our students were top in their fields or some of the kindest, most thoughtful, most compassionate leaders on campus. There was a line in the sand, and we fell on the wrong side of it. Now, you know what? I just read this again after letting it lie for 3 weeks or so, and I didn't realize that the phrase line in the sand was in this quote. But she's exactly right. And Amy says, it seems obvious to me that a Christian club choosing Christian leaders is a legitimate religious discrimination. It should seem equally obvious that kicking out any Christian group that doesn't conform to the administration's ideas of the right kind of theology is illegitimate religious discrimination. Yet there we are. Let's see. It urges local churches to step up their ministry to students. Let me see if I'm getting this right. Owen Strachan, she writes, called this a massive blow to the cause of religious liberty on college campus, but also urges local churches to step up their ministry to students. And if that's what comes out of this, if more college students become involved in local churches, well, that'll be a good thing. We'll see. She closes, ultimately, as angering as this is, that is, Amy here, is insulted by the irrationality of it as she is by the discrimination. Whatever comes out of this will be for our good, however difficult that good turns out to be. And I can't help but feel a twinge of excitement, wondering what new forms of ministry might be created to bring the gospel to universities and serve the students. Well, good for you, Amy. I like your positive attitude. That's why we got you here at Stand to Reason. Anyway, so that's the trend, friends. And there's going to be a lot more of this. So take heed right now. This is not going away. We cannot stick our head in the sand. We cannot, wave the white flag. And I'm not saying we have to fight these secular battles. I'm saying this is the nature of the secular university. And we need to point out what's going on, be clear about it, and then do the best we can in faithfulness to Christ under the circumstances. All right? All right, let's take a break, and then we'll have some more thoughts and your calls after this.
The Apostle Paul knew well the effect on those who engaged in empty chatter as they spread the virus of false knowledge. They went astray. So while entrusting the treasure of truth to Timothy, his disciple, and encouraging Timothy to entrust it to other faithful men, Paul also exhorted him to guard the treasure in 2 Timothy 1:14. Paul's word guard comes from the activity or office of a watchman who has the job of protecting those who are asleep from harm. It implies a deliberate, conscious act and demands discernment in knowing what it is that's been placed under our care. Guard the treasure was Paul's final message to Timothy before Paul's death. It reflected the heartbeat of his ministry. It reflects the heartbeat of Stand to Reason, too. Guard the treasure which has been entrusted to you. To learn more about Stand to Reason and how we're training Christian ambassadors to guard the treasure, visit us at str.org. Our website is full of unique and useful resources to train you to be an effective ambassador for Christ. That's str.org.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON.
Hey, latest news on Rethink. 3 days to go. We have 750 people signed up for Rethink. Unbelievable. First year, 300. Second year, 600. Now we got 750 and 3 days to go. And you know there's going to be walk-ins. We could hit 900 people. That's this fabulous Apologetics Youth Conference coming up September 26th to 27th. That's Friday and Saturday. Orange County, California, Crossline Church. And you can get all the information at rethinkapologetics.com. You can still save $10 in pre-conference registration. That's $39. If you show up at the door, we're going to charge you $49. It's still a bargain for Friday night, all day Saturday. And so I encourage you to consider that. If you have not made a decision yet, now's the time to do it. Of course, the Stand to Reason lineup will be there. Brett Kunkel, Alan Schliemann, I'll be there. Sean McDowell will be joining us. J.P. Jones, Tim Barnett, and Odd Thomas. Some of you know something about Odd Thomas. I haven't mentioned so much yet because it seemed like such an odd name, but he is a very creative guy. Trying to really think of how to describe what he does, but if you want to know, show up and you'll find out. It's powerful. Also, we've got an online event coming up with Brett Kunkel Thursday, October 2nd, 6:30 to 7:30 Pacific time, and he is going to be answering questions that we collect this weekend from students at the Rethink Conference. This is simply titled "What Students Are Asking." You can tune in October 7th. There, 6:30 to 7:30. Go to str.org right there on the face on the homepage. The details are there. For more information, or at that time, you can go to str.org/ask and participate with Brett in the question answer time there on the air. All right, let's. What did I say? Okay, October 2nd. Yeah, that's. You guys had it right. I said it wrong. October 2nd, as in number 2. Thank you, Melinda. Okay, let's go to Ian, Windsor, Ontario, Canada. Hey, Ian.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
Okay, is it getting cold up there yet?
It's starting to get there. Not too bad today, actually.
Well, I had some of the coldest, well, without a doubt, the coldest time of my year this year in Canada in January, and it was like 26 below zero, and that was Fahrenheit.
Is that in Calgary?
That was in just south of Calgary, right.
Yeah. Yeah, it gets pretty rough up there.
Yeah, it did. Although I understand that when you get that cold, the difference between Fahrenheit and centigrade diminishes significantly.
Yeah. It's funny, though, because I chuckle a little bit. I live in Canada, but I work over in the United States, in Michigan.
Uh-huh.
And
that's right.
They have a completely different perspective on weather.
How's that?
They actually, since I live in the south of Canada,
uh-huh.
Everywhere else in Canada is pretty much worse.
Uh-huh.
So we don't really, say too much, but in Michigan, they're always complaining about their winter and their weather. And
they got it so good compared to the rest of Canada. Right. Yeah, Windsor is right across from Detroit. Is that right?
Yeah, it is, actually.
Yeah. So you're
just south, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's an odd one of the few places where you actually have to go north to get to the U.S.
The States. Oh, okay.
Yeah, a bit of a thing of geography.
So what's on your mind today, Ian?
I'm calling because, I've called in a bunch of times and asked various questions, and I was wondering, excuse me, if you give me some advice on actually what some of these questions are actually coming out of is kind of a personal problem that I have, and a bit of a strange problem, and I was wondering if you could just give me some advice on how to deal with it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Be glad to try.
So I wrote a few points down here, just so I can get concise here. But it's basically, I'd say that I'm blessed / cursed with a sensitive conscience on certain things. So it's a blessing in a sense that I care very deeply about integrity and honesty. But it's a curse in that it drives me nuts mm-hmm. at times on certain things, like especially when it comes to certain controversial moral ethical questions mm-hmm. that Christians sort of land on different sides on.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, I called in on for contraception or mm-hmm. worldliness issues or things of that sort, divorce and remarriage, things of those nature.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not really calling about those specific things, but... Right.
But what you're suggesting is there are a lot of things like that where you feel like you may be overly sensitized in your conscience, and this causes you grief.
Right, yeah. So it's struggling. It's a struggle for me because some of these issues... seem like they sort of confine a sense of liberty that uh-huh. I have, Christian liberty. So then, so for example, I'm sitting there watching a movie with my wife or something, and then start wondering, well, is this worldly?
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd get basically hit with Romans 14:23. If you're doubting, then it's a sin. And it's sort of, it's an odd thing. It has the effect of sort of distorting my view of God.
Uh-huh.
And I realize this is not probably entirely accurate. It's, it kind of seems like God's sort of a petty, vindictive, just waiting for me to get something wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that Romans passage the one that says anything not of faith is sin?
Right.
Okay.
Now, part of this comes out of some certain emotional... psychological bent that I have.
Mm-hmm.
I've struggled with forms of anxiety and like obsessive compulsive types of tendencies.
Mm-hmm.
And I've talked with counselors about it. And
mm-hmm.
so, but just, I guess my question is, how do I deal with this kind of thing?
Yeah. Wow. I'm listening carefully because I have, for one, I have never encountered this before. It's one of those rare cases where this is the first time I've had to answer a question quite like this. I'm also flipping quickly to Romans 14 just to, to kind of take a quick look at this. I'm familiar broadly with the passage, that you're referring to. Let me just offer a couple of things that come to mind. The reason I paused is because as I was scanning this chapter 14, I saw this line, therefore, let us not judge one another anymore, but rather determine this not to put an obstacle or stumbling block in another person's way, a brother's way. What I thought when I read that is that we're not to judge one another anymore, but what you've done is you've put yourself under an extreme judgment.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering if Paul might have included, if this thing came up, that we don't put ourselves under this kind of judgment as well. We're not looking down on others who are not exercising their liberty. And that's kind of what he's talking about. But rather, maybe it's possible that we are overly judgmental of ourselves. Now, the way you characterized it was an overly sensitive conscience. But it's not clear to me that what you're feeling is your conscience. I mean, maybe you are just overly judgmental and possibly not of others, but of yourself. So, and again, I'm just casting about here a little bit with the thoughts that I have that come to mind on this, because it isn't like I've got, well, here's the breakdown of how this works. I don't know how this works entirely, but something's amiss here. What I think it would be a mistake for me to say to you is, well, follow your conscience. In most circumstances, I think that would be appropriate. But in this case, it doesn't sound like things are functioning properly.
No.
And this is why you've talked to counselors. This is your own assessment, and you're tormented by this. There is someone who is sitting in judgment on you in the exercise of your Christian liberty. Paul says, don't do that. He says, don't be sitting in judgment on Christians exercising their liberty in Christ. But in this particular case, and this is what makes it peculiar, you're the one who's sitting in judgment on yourself. At least arguably.
Right, you're right.
So it's not entirely clear to me, and this goes to this other statement, doubting is a sin and anything not of faith is sin. It is not entirely clear to me that any option that you have before you is one that you can throw your weight fully on.
Well, I mean, what's interesting is that some of these kind of issues, there's a, you know, if you want to call it a quote-unquote safe option, which is usually overly strict.
Yeah.
Which would end up leading to, I think, a very legalistic
yeah,
way of...
Yeah, this is why, in one sense, it's safe, because if you are excessively strict, then you're not... you're not going to fall into sin. Look, they had Pharisees that were called the bruised and bleeding Pharisees. And I mean, this is what I've heard. And they were called the bruised and bleeding Pharisees because they would walk around with their eyes closed so that they wouldn't see a woman and lust after her. But consequently, they'd run into things, and that's why they were called bruised and bleeding, or that's
right.
Why they were bruised and bleeding. So you could say, well, look, if I keep my eyes closed all the time, I'm never going to see a woman to lust after her. And I guess I could say, well, you got that right. Of course, it doesn't guarantee you won't lust. It just means that you won't be seeing a woman, and the sight of the woman would cause the lusting. But it strikes me that this is not the right way to deal with the lust problem.
Yeah. So, I guess it's tough for me to divide, you know, like you said, what's my conscience actually telling me versus is there something else here mm-hmm. that's sort of more emotionally based that I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah, and I can't help you with just because I don't have the skill to do that, nor
yeah.
I don't understand enough of the details. But it can be the case that you're Well, it often is the case that people's conscience is ill-informed. In fact, this is what Paul is speaking to some degree in the Romans and the Corinthians passage that's parallel to this. And that is that some people think something is wrong when it's not. That is a person who eats, who this is regarding the issue of meat sacrificed to idols. And he says, you know, look, there's nothing in that. An idol is nothing. So ultimately, we don't have to worry about the meat that we eat. What we have to worry about is the brother who may be misinformed. So the whole circumstance comes up because some people's conscience is misinformed. Now, Paul takes it seriously, and I don't want to dismiss it. Well, that's misinformed, so you don't worry about it. Paul does care about even the misinformed conscience. I'm just I'm looking at here chapter 14. Who are you to judge the servant of another? This is verse 4. To his own master he stands or falls. He will stand, for the Lord is able to make him stand. That's encouraging words. One person regards one day above another. Another regards every day alike. Each person must be fully convinced in his own mind. Now, this is where I think neither option is something you're fully convinced of in your own mind. If people who really believe that it is morally required to worship on Saturday instead of Sunday ought to worship on Saturday. Okay.
Right.
But in your case, though, you're vacillating.
Yeah, and
you're wondering. No,
go ahead.
Yeah, and you're wondering, maybe I should. Oh, so it isn't like you have a clear course. And then in verse 6, Paul says, he who observes the day observes it for the Lord, and he who eats does so for the Lord. For he gives thanks to God, and he who eats not for the Lord, he does not eat, and he gives thanks to God. No one lives for themselves. No one dies for himself. We live for the Lord. Now, it seems to me that in the midst of these kinds of things that you're facing, and I think everyone struggles in some measure with making moral decisions that seem ambiguous, and then the question in their own mind is, gee, am I doing the right thing? And that question is not always able to be clearly answered. You got to take your best shot. What I part of the application of Paul's comments here, I think, are that whatever we do, whatever shot we take, we do it heartily as to the Lord. That is, our sense is, okay, Lord, I don't know if it's A or B, but the two are set before me, and I got to do one or the other, and here's my best judgment. But you know what I'm trying to do? I'm living for you. That's what it is. I'm trying to live for you. Whether I eat or I don't eat, whether I drink or I don't drink, I'm doing it for the Lord. Now, you know, when I think when we watch TV, I think we have to ask ourselves sometimes, is this appropriate viewing? Are we putting the right things into our head? Maybe we should, you know, that I think these are appropriate. But ultimately, we have to answer the question there based on what we think the range of circumstances the best answer is. Mm. Could we be mistaken? Yeah, we could always be mistaken on things like that. We give it our best shot.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what else to tell you in this.
And I guess one thing I thought, you know, like, well, I mean, one option is I could just, every one of these issues, I could just troll the internet and try to research the heck out of it.
Yeah, you could, but nothing on the internet is going to tell you whether watching TV is too worldly or not.
Yeah.
I mean, I do not think that watching TV is worldly. That is, that somehow the act of watching a television set or a program is somehow complicit in some worldly design, that you are living in a non-Christian manner in virtue of watching TV. Now, it may turn out that that your viewing habits are problematic, that the things that you're watching are educating you as to a false view of the world. And this is why we don't let our children watch TV. I don't want somebody else preaching at them. We let them watch DVDs, and we're very careful about what they see. And so we don't, you know, and it's not all theological. A lot of it's fun and wholesome and entertaining and stuff like that. So there's nothing wrong with viewing an image on the screen.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I'm at, too. Like, I thought about, you know, that particular issue. I'm trying to think, like, what on earth could be wrong with it? And the only thing I come away with is, well, maybe the content. But then it's the same thing. Well, there's that little voice inside my head. Well, what if I'm wrong?
Well, look, at you. That is a question you can always ask.
Yeah.
What if I'm wrong? And if you're wrong, by grace you're saved through faith, not of yourselves. It is a gift of God. Therefore, being justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, who has given us this introduction in the faith in which we stand, and we exult in the hope of the glory of God. Him who does not work, but believes in a God who justifies the ungodly, to him it's reckoned as righteousness. Now, none of these verses am I citing to justify sinning. It is simply to make the case that we have a safety net, and the safety net is the grace of God. We do the best we can under the circumstances. I think it was Luther who said something like, trust God and sin on boldly. Now, of course, he wasn't encouraging people to sin. The point was there's safety in God. There's safety to make mistakes. And that, to me, has always been an encouragement. There is safety in the grace of God. And so if I risk and falter, I'm still caught in his arms. Okay.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Well, that's the best I can do. Sorry.
Yeah, I know it's a bit of an odd one.
It is novel, and that makes it interesting, but my heart goes out to you because I know you're struggling. This isn't academic.
No.
And I you know, my overall sense is that you're being too hard on yourself.
Yeah. It actually, I wouldn't want to apply a clinical label because I don't like them, but there are people, like, have you ever read John Bunyan's book, Grace Abounding?
Oh, I have not.
He actually struggled. Not. I don't have that same type of thing, but it's he struggled very intensely with a certain form of religious like obsession.
Yeah.
If you ever get the chance to read it,
yeah,
it's very, very vivid in this description.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, I like the title, Grace Abounding, because that's really the thought I want to leave you with, though.
Yeah.
That in it all, grace abounds towards you. There's safety in the cross. There's safety for us to work through the challenges and the difficulties, okay? All right?
All right, thanks a lot, Greg.
Ian, good to talk to you again.
Yep.
And I would encourage you to spend some time simply meditating on the grace of God. I cited something out of Ephesians 2, out of Romans 4, and out of Romans 5. Maybe spend some time in Romans 4 and 5. God's grace is sufficient. It is adequate for all of our need. And to me, I've fallen back on this notion so many times that I have safety in Christ while I'm trying to work out exactly how to deal with these issues. All right?
Yep.
All right, Ian.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you for your call. Let's take a break, and then I'll be back on Stand to Reason.
Have you been on a college campus lately? The intellectual and moral challenges awaiting our youth are immense. Are the students in your home, church, or youth group prepared for what lies ahead? Most Christian students are ill-prepared for an aggressive secular campus and culture. It's time to step up the training of our young people, and Stand to Reason will help you do just that. Join us this fall for our two-day Rethink Student Apologetics Conference. In September, we'll be in Orange County, California, to equip your students with a reason for the hope they have in Jesus. Go to RethinkApologetics.com and register today.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to iDonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit iDonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen, careful, intelligent discussion about ethics, values, and religion. That's what I aim to have every time I'm on the air here talking with you. Let's go to Scott here in Youngstown, Ohio. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Greg. How you doing?
Doing all right. Thanks.
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure. Glad to.
So I kind of found a better way to ask my question as I was waiting here.
All right.
So I guess, simply put, the question would be, how is church supposed to be done?
How is church supposed to be done?
And I'll tell you kind of just briefly where this came from.
Because the question says the proper use of the Bible as an authority, and this sounds like a very different kind of question.
Well, it kind of stems from, I had a buddy who, at work, who claims, you know, he's a Christian, mm-hmm. and basically what he's done is he's put together this website where he puts all these topical things on the website, tithing and so forth, and his arguments are just simply Bible verses. And so everything that he has to, whatever the topic is, he'll make his argument using Bible verses. And so the kind of thing that we were talking about was the way the American evangelical church these days, his big thing, I guess, he was keep going back to like the wealth and prosperity gospel and these TV ministers and all this who they keep preaching, claiming to be Christians, mm-hmm. But they're not. And so he's kind of put together this website. And so his arguments, like I said, always come from just simply taking Bible verses and that's it, making no other arguments. And so that's kind of where it began, and then it kind of, you know, went into, well, what is the role? How, you know, he says, well, the New Testament will say, it gives very strict guidelines on how church is to be done, and then kind of what is our role as Christians if we see that maybe it's not being done in the proper way?
Uh-huh.
Are we to do something about that? Are we to act on that, or you just simply go and find a new church?
Well, you know, of course I think that using Scripture as an authority regarding these kinds of issues is entirely appropriate. The question isn't whether Scripture is the authority or not. The question is whether the way the person is citing the text is legitimate. And that is, look, the Bible's the authority. Yes, so Judas went and hung himself. Go and do likewise. Well, those are Bible verses. Now, they're not exactly connected. There's a huge dot, dot, dot between those verses. But you can see how seizing one verse, then another verse, and another verse, you can construct things that simply are not sound. And
right.
So then going to passages, say, for example, how do you do, the Bible gives very strict guidelines on how to do church, is what you said your friend said. Well,
right.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if strict guidelines are the right way of describing it, but it certainly gives guidelines. But if what he's doing is quoting out of the early chapters of Acts about how they had all things in common, those are not guidelines about how to do church. Those are descriptions about how Christians acted in the first century, the early part of the first century. And so if someone takes a description as a directive, then they are abusing the Scripture, and if you abuse the Scripture, then make it say something that it isn't actually saying, then it's no longer God's word at that point.
Right.
So a lot depends on exactly how he is using the text in these circumstances. We had a caller just a moment ago. I cited three passages, boom, 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 that had to do with the grace of God. So I am recommending the teaching of these verses to him to consider for his set of circumstances. So I am quoting the Bible and using it as an authority to answer the issue that he was facing. Nothing wrong with that. Now, in my mind, I'm not abusing the text because even though I'm citing a verse, I didn't just read the verse, I know what the passages are about. And so the way that I used the verse was legitimate in light of the teaching of the larger passage. I don't know if that's always the case with the friend that you're describing. So
I'm not sure either. I think there's a little bit more, I think, going. I mean, when I first met him, his complaint was that he's been kicked out of 8 different churches that he's gone to. So obviously there's a red flag. So I kind of investigate a little more, and I think, okay, well, his big thing was tithing. He goes to these churches and they're preaching this, again, this wealth, prelf, and prosperity kind of gospel that, you know, and all the wrong messages about tithing.
Uh-huh.
So he feels the need then to, I guess, speak up.
Well, see, this is interesting.
The
yeah.
congregation or whatever. And so he's basically, the pastor didn't want to hear it, so he's out there just throwing Bible verses to the congregation because he says, you know, I know that the Bible doesn't teach it. And so he's just kind of throwing the stuff out there, and I said, well, maybe it's just a tactical thing at this point. I mean,
it could
there's
be
probably a way you're undermining the pastor and all of this. Maybe there's a better way to go about it. So
yep.
That just kind of got me going, thinking, well, what is the proper response in a circumstance like that?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I have never, I don't exactly know how he's opposed the pastors, but I don't think I've ever in 40 actually, in a couple of, next week it'll be 41 years on Sunday, I have ever kind of stood up and opposed a pastor.
See, this seems strange to me too, but now he's saying, well, it talks in the Bible that, he's like, the only minister I know is Jesus, everyone else is just elders, and you know, he's not, just because you have an education doesn't mean anything, and, you know, if you want to disprove me, then, you know, just use Bible to do it, and we're called to test each other's spirit, and I should be able to stand up at any time if I'm being led, and I've gone through the whole decision-making and all that, you know, so there's all
led.
These different things I don't even know really
or
how to even start.
Well, look, is this a person, a very good friend of yours?
I wouldn't say very good. He's a coworker. I mean, somebody that I care about. And I mean,
yeah,
I just,
sure. Good for you.
Yeah, I mean,
What I was thinking about, though, with regards to the churches that teach all this nonsense, is instead of standing up and opposing it all, and when you tell me he's been thrown out at 8 or 10 churches or whatever, then you wonder, why is he? He didn't leave 8 or 10 churches. He got thrown out. That means he got he was doing something obnoxious. And sometimes you just let the dead bury the dead, all right? You just leave them go. Now, he feels the obligation because he thinks he's been led by the Spirit to speak out against them. Well, he's not going to get support for that notion in the Bible because led by the Spirit doesn't mean what he apparently thinks it means in the way that he used it. It means something entirely different. So, and you already know about this because you've looked at the material in Galatians 5 and in Romans 8. It means living a holy life, putting to death the deeds of the flesh, overcoming the flesh. That's what being led by the Spirit means. It doesn't mean getting a nudge from the Spirit to go and make a jerk out of yourself. Now, in fact, and that reminds me, in 1 Peter, so what you want to use a verse here? Look at 1 Peter, which is after Hebrews. All right, here it is. 1 Peter says that do not be surprised. Verse 12, chapter 4. Do not be surprised, beloved, at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing as though something strange were happening to you, but at the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing. So these are Christians who are being persecuted, right? And he goes on to qualify it. If you are reviled for the name of Christ, you're blessed, because the Spirit of glory in God rests on you. But make sure that none of you suffers as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer or a troublesome meddler.
Yeah.
There are some things worth suffering for, the cause of Christ, but if you're getting heat because you're a busybody, a meddler, you're annoying, you're causing trouble, then the trouble you get, you deserve. That's kind of a paraphrase of Peter.
Mm-hmm.
It strikes me that in your friend is maybe a little bit like the troublesome meddler here. I don't know.
Well, that's what I kind of was asking. That's what I told him it seemed like. I mean, but part of me thinks that, like, I feel like he has good intentions for what that's worth, and that he's frustrated with maybe some of the experiences he's had in different churches.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but I guess I just don't really know how to convince him that.
Well, there's a lot of passages that say that we should be seeking peace with people. At the end of Romans, it says, if possible, as far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men.
Mm-hmm.
And the book of Proverbs is filled with this kind of stuff. You know, the one who guards his lips preserves his life. He who opens wide his mouth comes to ruin. So that's one of many that counsel against speaking out of turn. And I have a feeling that your friend does that, but your friend feels justified because he's able to proof text passages that makes him feel that he is in the right in acting the way he's acting. But it from what you've told me, it does not appear that he is. It seems like he's a troublemaker, which is why he's gotten tossed out of these churches. He may be right in his view. I agree that the New Testament does not teach tithing. Tithing was a function of the law that we are not under. Jews tithe, not Gentiles, Jews. In the church, giving is right. It's commanded, but not tenthing. Tithing is tenthing. And frankly, I think I probably would agree with your friend that these Word Faith churches are teaching tithing for all the wrong motives.
I agree. I just was, you know, then it's like, well, then on these kinds of things in the church, you know, what role do we have, or I guess, or what responsibility do we have to speak up on anything, I guess, that we thought was
If you're in a local church, if you are a member of a local church, then speaking to your pastor where you're a member and you're a part of the body, when something significantly wrong comes up in teaching or something, is appropriate. You have to remember that you know, you go with your hat in your hand, because pastors are spiritual authorities over those under them. And
right.
there are guidelines for how far that goes, and 1 Peter 5 talks about that. But at the same time, there is a legitimacy to addressing your pastor on these issues. But your friend doesn't seem to be a member of these churches. He doesn't believe.
Well, yeah,
in the doctrine.
He doesn't think that there should be any requirements for membership, like just going to the church.
Look at, never mind. I'm not using the word membership in a technical sense like this.
Oh, okay.
He is not a part of that local body. He is not
right.
part.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
he is an outsider that's coming in and causing trouble. If you are an ongoing participant in the community, so I'm weighing my words carefully now, if you're an ongoing participant in the community, then that pastor is over you, the pastor of that community, and the other leadership. And so when there are things that are wrong, you go to the leadership of your community and you talk with them about it. And the time might come when you have done what you can and you realize, this is not the place I need to stay because our differences are too profound. And then you leave. You don't get thrown out.
Yeah, that's what I told him. And he said, well, no, I mean, I got to tell the congregation, you know, they're being misled.
Yeah.
Well, now I don't think I agree with that.
Well,
I thought, look, if you're just an average guy, I don't mean to put him down, but like me, we're just average. We're not leadership in the church.
Yeah.
And you were able to figure this out, then doesn't the congregation? They should be able to figure this out.
Well, he's not the prophet, and what he wants to do is he wants to. It sounds like he wants to go in and tell everybody where they're wrong, and
right.
and make a big fuss. And this is an incorrigible kind of person. The picture I'm getting now is not an attractive one about him.
Right,
this is not a good situation. So I think he's going down the wrong path with this, and you're good for you because you're trying to encourage him. But I think he's in the wrong place. Doesn't sound like he's teachable, though. He's not going to listen to you because he's always got a verse that's going to back him up in some distorted way. So good luck with him. And thank you for your call, Scott. That's it for this hour, friends. Been good spending time with you. One more hour to go here at Stand to Reason. Hope you stay with us. Greg Kokol back at you here. Actually, first segment of our final hour. But I am back because we've had 2 hours already. Hey, thanks for joining me. I don't know if this is your first hour or not, but I'm glad you're on board. Stand to Reason is the show. And it's the place to get a well-furnished mind. I have something I want to read to you as I launch the show here. Now, this is something I've had for a long time. And it is not written by a Christian. But it is a topic that I have not only talked about but written about. And it's something that plagues Christians because they get hit with this kind of nonsense. And it has to do with the question of whether, or I should say the assertion that the whole account of Jesus of Nazareth is a refabrication of ancient mythology of dying and rising gods. This is an old charge, by the way. It's gotten some boost in recently. But this goes back to the late 19th century, The Golden Bough, a novel written by a guy who basically made the same claim that, let's see, James Frazier, 1890. The copycat theory, basically, and it's taken many forms. Some of you might have seen the Zeitgeist movie or know of it, a kind of quasi-documentary that is meant to explain how the myth of Jesus came to be, as these ancient myths of Osiris and Mithras and Horus are kind of cobbled together to form the story of Jesus of Nazareth. Which account has all these particular details in it? Born of a virgin, 12 disciples, 3 wise men, December 25th, resurrected, and on and on and on, that really are all parts of ancient myths. There's nothing new in the gospel accounts, in the story or the myth of Jesus. This was a main a piece of the argument that Dan Brown advanced in The Da Vinci Code. So I have actually written a piece on this called The Recycled Redeemer, and I give a number of reasons why this is nonsense. It's just complete nonsense. Some of you might have the book Come Let Us Reason, New Essays in Christian Apologetics, Paul Copan and William Lane Craig, editors. And there are 2 articles there dealing with this, or 2 chapters. One of them by Mary Jo Sharp does the story of Jesus mimic pagan mystery stories. Another by Mark Forman challenging the Zeitgeist movie Parallelomania on steroids. Both of these addressing the same question. What's fun about this piece that I want to read to you is that this isn't a piece of Christian apologetics. This is an article that I found last year, and it's called 6 Famous Documentaries That Were Shockingly Full of and CRAP. So I won't say the word just to be genial here and polite. It's a bunch of garbage, all right? And this is from cracked.com. And I just had so much fun with it. It's not very long. I'll just read it to you. And one of the documentaries was Religulous by Bill Maher, a famous atheist who has taken every opportunity he can to try to make fun of Christians, a comedian, so that he's often funny when he does it. But funny and sound are 2 different things. And so here, this person looks at this documentary. This person, you'll see at the end, not a particular friend of Christianity, has this to say. In Religulous, Bill Maher sets out to make you question what you think you know about God, telling you everything church leaders don't want you to know. He interrogates everyone from truck stop parishioners to pious scientists to visitors of a holy amusement park, poking holes in their beliefs by pointing out things like how the original sin isn't mentioned in the Bible or how the Christ mythology is eerily similar to other ancient religions, At one point, a Tumblr-ready slideshow view informs us of the many similarities between Jesus and the Egyptian god Horus. Now, they don't go into the details here. There's a show that you can watch, an animation of thing here, so you can see it. But anyway, he continues, "Man, that's some incriminating evidence there. How come the entire Catholic Church hasn't collapsed under the weight of this one documentary?" And then he tells why. And the way this article is structured, it looks at these six documentaries that are full of garbage and gives a summary of the film and then offers the fallacy that drives it. So there is the summary, and here's the fallacy. All this Jesus was copied from earlier religion stuff has been going around the internet for a while, and it will make you look awesome if you post it on a Halo message board, but none of it's true. The Egyptian links have been debunked by actual Egyptologists. Let's start with the virgin birth part. You got to make some pretty big logical jumps to the claim that any of those earlier gods were born from virgins, having come from a mother seven times over, Krishna, or some freaky necrophilia, Horus, and come from under a rock, Mithras. These are all ones that were alleged to have been virgin births, not a chance. That is, the stories themselves don't say this when you go back to the primary source documentation. He continues, then there's a resurrection thing. Contrary to Mars claims, Mithras was never resurrected, and the older versions of the guy's story don't have any of the Jesus similarities. Those similarities, let's see, come about in the 1st or 2nd century AD, that is, after Jesus was born. Horus, like Mithras, was also never resurrected, didn't have 12 apostles, and didn't raise Asar from the dead, which doesn't translate to Lazarus even a little bit. There isn't even any record of a figure called Anup, the baptizer. The closest we come is Anubis, the god of embalming, which astute readers will note is a little different from baptism. That's the way he spells little. Good point. Oh, by the way, original sin is totally in the Bible, and you'd be hard-pressed to find a scholar who disagrees with the overwhelming evidence that a person, not necessarily a divine being, matching Jesus' description existed during his purported lifetime, which is true. So where did Marr get all of his garbage? Probably from the viral documentary, in quotes, Zeitgeist, which doesn't cite any sources, or, and this is a serious possibility, The Da Vinci Code, which the writer says is about as historically accurate as the movie Splash, which is about a mermaid. None of this matters, and he concludes, and this shows his colors. He's not a Christian, but he recognizes garbage when he sees it. None of this means the Christian Bible is right or that it represents the one true religion, but if you think something's baloney, that's a synonym for what he actually wrote. If you think something is baloney, the answer is not more baloney, which is exactly what Bill Maher gives in Religulous and exactly what you find in the documentary Zeitgeist. Now, I'm not putting Bill Maher down because he's an atheist or Zeitgeist down because it doesn't agree with me. Both make factual claims about history, and both are false in their claims. It's amazing how many Christians have been upended by these kinds of claims, these assertions that they have all this historical evidence that the story of Jesus, the myth of Jesus, is just a fictional character. Jesus is just a fictional character, and he was created from other myths. Of course, the question that I have and that I essentially ask in the piece that I wrote on the issue titled Recycled Redeemer, which you can find at str.org, is how do they know it's a myth to begin with? Jesus, that is. I hope you realize that you cannot declare any particular alleged historical account mythological simply because you are able to identify other accounts that predate it that are similar in a significant way, even if they were similar in a significant way, just because they predate this later account does not mean the later account came from them. That is a logical fallacy called post hoc ergo propter hoc. Just because one thing comes before the other doesn't mean the first thing caused the second. It's very straightforward. And C.S. Lewis identifies the problem here, too, putting it in a little different way in his article Bulverism, which you can find in his book God in the Dock, a book of essays. And here's the way he puts it. First, you have to show that a person is mistaken before you can, it's meaningful to ask why he's mistaken. So let me say that again because it's really important. First, you have to show that a person is mistaken before it's meaningful to ask why he's mistaken. These people who advanced this idea have already assumed there was no Jesus, that Jesus is a fictional character, that Jesus of Nazareth never existed. And so now they're scratching about trying to figure out, well, where did such a story come from? And they imagine they found parallels in the ancient myths of Egypt and Rome. But first point, the point of this particular author here, is the similarities don't exist. All those claims that are made of similarities just simply are false claims. You look at the primary source documentation, which this Zeitgeist so-called documentary does not do. It never cites an original source. It cites other people who cite other people who cite the first people. It's a big circle, but none of them go back to the original sources. For those people who go back to the original sources, there aren't, these parallels simply do not exist, but that doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter because just because there is a parallel that came first doesn't mean that the second thing copied from the first. Now, the first time that I heard this claim was from American atheist Michael Shermer. I heard him make it in a debate with Doug Guyvet, and I've heard him make this claim since then. And it immediately occurred to me, though I've never done this, I did debate Michael about 4 years ago, actually, next Sunday. Oh, wait a minute, is that right? No, 4 years ago, December 30th, so a couple months up. Anyway, I debated Michael, but this issue didn't come up. I did think of this, though. When I heard him, it was immediately apparent to me what the flaw was in the reasoning. And it's best illustrated this way. I could have gone up to Michael Shermer that night when I first heard him make this claim and said, Michael Shermer, yes, that's me. No, you couldn't be Michael Shermer. Well, yes, I am. No, you couldn't be. Why do you say I couldn't be Michael Shermer? Because I have met four people in the last month that claim to be Michael Shermer, and they weren't. Therefore, you can't be. Now, obviously, that's a mistake, right? Just because there were imposters or interlopers or whatever before doesn't mean the real McCoy can't show up. Now, how would Michael Shermer be able to demonstrate to me that he was the real deal and not an imposter? Well, it's actually quite simple. All he had to do was show me his bona fides, pull out his driver's license or his passport or something like that. Once he showed me his bona fides, then I'd know he's the guy. Well, the same thing can be done here. What are Jesus' bona fides? I'll tell you what the bona fides are. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. These documents can be tested to see if they're historically reliable. If it turns out that certified historians on the main, and in fact it's hard to find an exception, believe that these accounts give accurate depictions of the life of Jesus of Nazareth, even though they may not agree with every particular detail in the account, for example, the religious. If these people do this based on the canons of historical analysis, well, then we have every reason to believe that Jesus of Nazareth lived and did the kinds of things, by and large, that are recorded there in those primary source historical documents. And if it turns out that there are documents more ancient that seem parallel, so be it. That doesn't change the bona fides. And, in fact, just as a curiosity, get on your internet connection and Google up futility. Now, all by itself, you're going to get a lot of nonsense, but this is the title of a book that was written in 1898, I believe, and it was a book about a transatlantic voyage of an indestructible ocean liner named Titan, believe it or not, which on its maiden voyage between New York and London, traveling at 14 knots in the middle of a March or April night, struck an iceberg and sunk. And since the lifeboats available for the people was one half of the 3,000 population on the ship, like one third of the people on that ship perished, or maybe more. Now, that was a fiction. It's called futility. And 14 years later, it happened. The Titanic struck the iceberg. And there are probably 15 specific particular details that are exactly the same as the fiction written. Now, is this extraordinary? Of course it is. It's an extraordinary coincidence. But the point I'm making is, even if there were all of these parallels in the life of Jesus that we found in ancient documents and in ancient myths, that itself would not be enough to demonstrate that the life of Jesus found in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John was itself a fiction. You'd have to look at the primary source historical documents themselves and determine if they are sound or not, because first you have to show that a person is mistaken before it is meaningful to ask why he's mistaken. If you want to check out my article, go to sdr.org. All the details are in there, including the details about futility. The article is called Recycled Redeemer, and just before the show, I jumped on our website myself and typed the title into the search bar and found the article, so you're welcome to it. And the whole case is clear there. You might also check out Come Let Us Reason, New Essays in Christian Apologetics by Copan and Craig, editors, and check out the two articles there that go in a lot more detail than I was able to. All right, let's take a break and then take your calls on Stand to Reason.
You can find STR on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians. Want to know what is going on with STR? Speaking events, new podcasts, resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find all of our social media connections at str.org.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org, or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
All right, let's take some calls here at Stand to Reason. Let's talk with Jamie in Pasadena, California. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, Greg. Can you hear me?
Oh, man, you are busting up really weirdly.
Do
you have another connection that you can make, like a landline, or I guess you don't?
Yeah, I do. Is it getting any better?
Okay, you know, it's almost impossible. It sounds like you're underwater,
okay.
And your words are bubbling out.
Uh-oh.
It's one of those kind of things. But I know what your question is.
Okay.
And so what I'll do, because it has to do with the Apostles' Creed about Jesus descending into hell, and your question is this heresy or is this heterodox that would be false but not heretical. It's like a misdemeanor. It's not a, you know, capital crime kind of thing theologically. So
why is it? Yeah.
Yeah, okay. You know, the connection seems to have cleared up a little bit.
Oh, okay.
So the Apostles' Creed says that Jesus was died and was buried and descended into hell, and then on the third day he rose again from the dead. Now, let me recommend a source for you, and I'm pausing because I always forget the Reformed theology guy who did the Wayne Grudem. Thank you, Melinda. Wayne Grudem, G-R-U-D-E-M, in his Systematic Theology, the larger one. There's kind of a popular version that's a smaller one. In his Systematic Theology,
I have it.
Well, he goes into a lot of detail. This is the thing that I enjoy. I think it's a good systematic, but I enjoyed this particular part more than anything else that I saw there. I had so much fun because he really does a good job doing an assessment of the Apostles' Creed, particularly this aspect of it. And I'll give you the kind of the short course here. This phrase, descended into hell, does not show up in the earliest versions of the Apostles' Creed. It shows up later. Now, keep in mind, a creed is a creed. It's a man-made document expressing what a group confesses to or believes. So the fact that it wasn't in the original doesn't mean it can't be added later. You know, it isn't like, well, that's not in the original biblical text and some scribe added it later, so that's not really the Word of God. That would be a problem in biblical text, but it doesn't apply quite the same way here. But I think the significance here, as I recall Grudem's analysis, and he actually has a chart in there that by which you can track the textual history of this phrase. Remember how it shows up. It says, he was crucified, died, and was buried. He descended into hell, and the third day he arose again from the dead.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the word hell is also a word that's often is an English word that is translated often from the Latin word Hades. And Hades is Sheol, is a synonym for Sheol, which is the nether world, that is the place of the dead. We think of the word hell now in a very specific way. We think, you know, you're down in the flames, and this is the place of torment for unbelievers, made for Satan and his angels, and eventually will be the abode of all who, in one way or another, have followed him. That's the place of final judgment. So when we say hell, we think of that place. But in the earlier use of the language, it wasn't so much that place as it was the netherworld, the place of the dead. And this appears to be the way the phrase was intended, even when it showed up initially in later documents. So the earliest form of the creed doesn't have it. Then it shows up, and it looks like it is simply a restatement of the line before it. So that is, he died and was buried. That is, he went to the nether world. Okay? It isn't saying he's died and buried, and then Jesus went to the hell place and suffered and was in torment for 3 days, and then he escaped or something like that. It was meant to just to restate the reality of his death. It was to underscore that he was a dead man. And then he was a live man. Crucified, died, buried in the netherworld, boom, and now he's resurrected from the dead. That was the point. Nothing more theological was intended by the addition of that phrase, okay? And then more was made of it as time went on. So my takeaway from this is that the phrase descended into hell should probably be struck because it does not reflect any biblical teaching, and he goes into Grudem goes into depth on that, and it is not a core to any theological notion. It just crept in to mean one thing, and it came to mean another thing, and it just creates confusion, so there's no reason not to strike it. Anyway, the Apostles' Creed isn't our ultimate creedal confession because, as many noted there in the first few centuries, even heretics of a different sort could affirm the Apostles' Creed. So it wasn't adequate to separate the faithful from the heretical. Not completely. You know, more needed to be said, and this is why you had additional councils in the Nicene Creed. We've got, is that us or is that coming from him? Oh, that's our? I mean, I can hear a lot of crackling in the background here, so I'm... Okay, go ahead. I think I lost you again.
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're back to bubbles again, so...
Sorry.
It's not your fault. It's just electronic stuff here. I don't know. We're just experiencing a little trouble on our end. Let me just... Okay. Jamie, let me just leave it at that for now. Since you've got... Wayne Grudem's book, you can take a look at that. All I've done is restate what he does in a much more thoroughgoing fashion. So I'd like to direct you back there. The summary is good for the rest of the listeners, though. Strike that phrase. It just creates confusion. If you want to recite it, fine. Just keep in mind that what that phrase means is Jesus was dead, buried, and then he rose again from the dead. Thanks for the call, Jamie. Let's see. Let's try. Shall I deal with? Let me deal with Nancy. Okay, we had. I got a Norman coming up here in a few minutes in Manitoba, but Nancy was on board. She couldn't stay, but she left her question behind, and I want to address it. Apparently, and she was of necessity, as you'll see, she had to be vague anyway. So, apparently, in our church, there is an ethical issue. There is an ethical breach of one of the members of the leadership. Is that right, Melinda? Okay, so there is a member of the leadership that is involved in some kind of moral problem. Now, I'm taking it to be a substantive moral problem, or else she wouldn't be calling in about somebody who's just crabby or annoying or something like that. And the question is, and she knows about it, but others do not. So she has some inside information, and her question is, what should she do? Well, this is a hard issue in the sense of being burdensome. I mean, it's unfortunate that one has to face this, but I don't think the correct action is difficult to figure out, presuming, again, that this is a weighty moral concern. If she knows about it but others don't, it does raise a question to me. Is this something that is a result of her discovery? That is, she discovered something on her own that revealed this problem to her, but other people don't know about it. Let's just take it like that because that seems to be the way it came down. If she knows about it, but nobody else knows about it but this man, and it's a weighty moral concern, I think she ought to talk to the man. This is somewhat of a Matthew 18 circumstance. And the Matthew 18 circumstance says that if there's a brother that is caught sinning, then first go to that brother or sister, of course, individually, and try to reason with them, talk with them. And if that Christian responds, repents, turns, you've won your brother, Jesus says. Okay. Now, if not, if he does not listen, here I'm reading Jesus, If he does not listen, take one or two more with you, so that by the mouth of two or three witnesses every fact may be confirmed. Now, the fact that's going to be confirmed in this regard, it seems to me, is the resistance that this person is giving to being corrected morally here. Now, once the witnesses are in play and the person still does not respond, Jesus says if he refuses to listen to them, then tell it to the church. That means you expand the circle. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. In other words, you disfellowship that person as an act of discipline. Paul talks about this in 1 Corinthians 5. There is one other guideline that is important, and it's in, I think it's in 1 Timothy. And that is that when it comes to church leadership, you do not entertain an accusation against them except for on the basis of two or three witnesses. That is, you don't just follow rumors. And particularly when it comes to leadership, too much is at stake. If there is a leader, there's a charge against, you've got to have multiple witnesses. However, if you do have multiple witnesses, then that leader comes under actually a greater sense of discipline. He should be rebuked in the presence of all so that others are fearful of sinning. I don't know why this can't be followed in this particular case. It may be that no one else knows about this sin except for Nancy in North Carolina. And it may be that that's the way it can stay if she's able to confront the brother and win the brother. And that's the way it should be. You don't spread gossip. And it is no defense for spreading gossip that the gossip is true. Doesn't matter if it's true. That's not the point. This is a need-to-know basis, you know. And there's a proverb that says, the words of a whisperer are like dainty morsels and go deep down into the heart of a man. And this is a little bit cryptic, but I think the point is that when you tell somebody a secret about a person, about something bad, it's very difficult for that person who hears it to get that out of their head. And the next time they encounter this person, what do you think they're thinking? They're thinking about that whispered morsel that is down in there. Oh, yeah, I know what you did. And so we're not to do that. We're not to poison other people's thinking or their minds regarding another person in that way. Instead, we have a guideline to follow. We keep our mouths shut and we go to the person or persons that are involved, and we deal with that. And if there's not a response, then we bring somebody else, particularly on an egregious issue. One last thing I'll mention, this is from the book of Galatians. And Paul writes there in Galatians 6, if anybody is caught in a stumble, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, looking to yourselves, lest you also be tempted. And so I think this is meant to address an attitude. Yeah, sometimes people are stumbling badly. Brothers, sisters are to go as appropriate and seek to restore that person in a spirit of gentleness, being mindful that we stumble ourselves. And it may be us next time around. But there is to be this kind of healing that takes place in the body of Christ as we work with each other to confront and to bring to repentance. Proverbs has another one, and I'm going to go to break here in just a second, that is helpful here, and that is, faithful are the wounds of a friend. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. The kisses of an enemy are deceitful, but the wounds of a friend are faithful. Sometimes we need to tell our friends the hard thing that's really good for them. And it's an act of our love, caring, and friendship to them to do so. All right? Let's run to break, and then we'll get to Norman in Manitoba, Canada, after this.
The Apostle Paul knew well the effect on those who engaged in empty chatter as they spread the virus of false knowledge. They went astray. So while entrusting the treasure of truth to Timothy, his disciple, and encouraging Timothy to entrust it to other faithful men, Paul also exhorted him to guard the treasure in 2 Timothy 1:14. Paul's word guard comes from the activity or office of a watchman who has the job of protecting those who are asleep from harm. It implies a deliberate, conscious act and demands discernment in knowing what it is that's been placed under our care. Guard the treasure was Paul's final message to Timothy before Paul's death. It reflected the heartbeat of his ministry. It reflects the heartbeat of Stand to Reason, too. Guard the treasure which has been entrusted to you. To learn more about Stand to Reason and how we're training Christian ambassadors to guard the treasure, visit us at str.org. Our website is full of unique and useful resources to train you to be an effective ambassador for Christ. That's str.org.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON.
Final segment here on Stand to Reason, final segment of the final hour. And just a reminder, 3 days to go. This is the last chance I can tell you about it. Rethink Apologetics Youth Conference. 750 people already signed up. I know there are going to be a bunch of people at the door. They're going to pay an extra $10. That would be $49, which is a bargain at twice the price. But you can still sign up now. $39. Save yourself $10 at rethinkapologetics.com, rethinkapologetics.com. Of course, this is the Rethink Apologetics Youth Conference coming up in 3 days, the 26th and 27th of September. Orange County, Crossline Church, all the details are there. Full raft of fabulous speakers. Just as a little sideline here, I will be there with my daughter, Annabeth, who's only 9, but she's going to come to the sessions. The Kunkels are going to be there in force. Not only Brett hosting the event really as MC and doing some of the sessions, and Brett Kunkel and Alan Schliemann and Sean McDowell, J.P. Jones, just a great lineup. But he's also going to have his brood as well, which will make my daughter happy, but they're going to be helping at tables, and it's a family affair for us. So we look forward to seeing you at the Rethink Apologetics Youth Conference September 26th and 27th. Once again, rethinkapologetics.com. Sign up now. Save yourself $10 at the door. All right, let's talk with Norman. And Norman, welcome. How are you, Norman?
Hi, how are you?
Good. Glad to have you on board.
Thanks for having me. I just have a question about how we should understand the blessings that Jacob gives the sons of Joseph as well as his own sons at the end of Genesis in chapter 48 and 49.
Uh-huh. Let me kind of flip there real quickly. Did you say 48 and 49? Is it, or 38 and 39? What chapters?
48, 49.
Oh, 48, 49. Okay. And direct me now to the specific verses. Genesis 48.
Well, it sort of starts specifically around verse 17 of chapter 48.
Okay.
And my wife was looking online, and she came across a number of commenters who seemed to interpret these blessings of not only Joseph's sons, but the sons of Jacob as being prophecy for sort of today. And they see the sons and grandsons of Joseph as standing in place of modern nations. For instance, they use Genesis 48:19 as a reference to being Great Britain and Ephraim being the United States.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm glad you called on this. Let me just read this so everybody knows where we're at here. Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on the head of Ephraim and his left hand on Manasseh's head. So he crossed his hands and he ended up giving the right hand blessing to the younger. And Jacob, this is the grandfather now. So you have Abraham, Isaac, which is Israel, and Jacob. No, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which is Israel. Jacob is blessing Joseph's sons, right? Yeah.
Yes.
And Joseph saw that his father got his hands mixed up, and it displeased him, and he tried to change that. But his father said, no, this is the way it's going to be. I know my son, I know, but this is the way my blessing is going to be. And so he gives this blessing, and the blessing, he says, is by you, Israel. He blessed them that day, saying, by you, Israel, will pronounce blessings, saying, may God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. Thus he put Ephraim before Manasseh. Then Israel said to Joseph, behold, I'm about to die. I'm going to take you back to the father, blah, blah, blah. So there's the blessing. Now, I don't know. I'm pausing here because it's frustrating. There you have, may God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. He put Ephraim before Manasseh. Now, before it, he says, you will become a people who will also be great. However, the younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. Why anybody would feel justified in reading back 3,000 years into this, Great Britain and the United States, completely escapes me. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I had the same reaction, but I contacted my uncle who has a theology degree, and I asked him, you know, how should we be reading it? And he said that it was kind of vague, but said that, you know, it is partial blessing, but also partially prophecy, and he didn't really elaborate. So,
well, if you want to say partially, it is a blessing for future prosperity. So you cannot separate the blessing from the prophecy. Because the blessing is that you will become a great nation. This is going to happen in the future. So I don't have any qualms with taking this as prophetic, given the words of the blessing. They are for a future impact. But that doesn't mean they are prophetic in the sense that they apply 3,000 years later to America and Great Britain. I see absolutely no reason whatsoever to read it that way. And it strikes me as a little bit ethnocentric to do so. Why can't this be Ethiopia? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I had suggested a multitude of nations could have been ancient Rome if you want to read it that way.
If you're going to try to specify which nation is in view here, you know, you've got lots and lots of options probably. I think we should just take this at face value. If you look at the promise of God, is to prosper Abraham and make a great nation out of him, and that would be Abraham, then Isaac, then Jacob, and out of Jacob, then you have the 12 tribes of Israel, and the 12 tribes all prospered in some way, and here's a special blessing of prosperity on two of those tribes, the two sons of Joseph. Levi didn't have a portion in the country because that was the priesthood. Joseph's portion was divided between his two sons, Manasseh and Benjamin. I'm sorry, Ephraim and Manasseh here. And so you have a split there under Joseph. He gets two portions, and this is a blessing. That's all it is. It's a blessing of prosperity. I don't see any reason to make any more of this. And I think sometimes when people take these general statements like this that have value in understanding their general claim and try to then start 3,000 years later, start putting national names on them, I think it's silly. I think you're...
Okay. Well, I agree. That's what I was thinking. But as I said, she saw a number of commentators and stuff, and they all seem to point to this idea that it's the key to understanding sort of end times prophecy and being able to associate these sons and grandsons with modern nations is what helped us to sort of understand what's going to come in the future.
Well, I don't know how it is possible to do that, to make a connection between these two individuals who lived 3,000 years ago and somehow follow their progeny down in an orderly way to find out who the nations are. And there is a tactic from the book Tactics that I'm employing in this particular case, and that is the tactic called Rhodes Scholar. A Rhodes Scholar is a tactic in which you ask of the scholar. You have scholarly pronouncements, just like you've mentioned. Well, there are commentators who say this. Okay, great. Now I know what that scholar believes. What I need to know is why he believes it. I need to know the reasons why the scholar thinks that this verse here somehow portends the rise of the U.S. and Great Britain as nations that come from Abraham's loins. There is a movement called British Israelism that some cultic groups adhere to, but I don't see the biblical justification for that either, and this sounds like it. So just because the commentators say that is not enough for me. I'm going to say, look, I'm reading the same passage you guys are reading. I don't see how you get that. So what is your justification for believing that this is somehow a key to prophecy? I mean, they're not here to answer that question, but unless they give you a really, really good reason, I don't have any reason to take their scholarly assessments seriously. I'm just going to let that one go.
I felt the same way. And when you watch sort of the videos and stuff, they just sort of give it as a blanket statement that this is the way it is. And then they don't explain how they make that conclusion. They just start offering up their books for you to buy.
Well, there you go. There you go. So anyway, that's my two cents on the issue. All right, Norman?
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, I appreciate your call. I got one more thing I want to deal with before we close the hour. And this is an email question that came in. And there's four or five paragraphs here. I'm just going to read the basic question. And the basic question is, would you allow your child to visit the home of a child being raised by a homosexual couple? Would the sex of the couple matter? And this apparently is a question that was put to the person who sent the email. And they write, as it has been put to me, the child is not responsible for their circumstances. Well, this is obviously true. If you have a child being raised by a homosexual couple, who would blame the child for that? Nobody. But it does raise a question that I'm sure that people are facing now, because you have not the proliferation at all, but it is not completely unusual to encounter a same-sex couple who has children. They may be down the street. Those children may play with your children in school, that kind of thing. So this is a challenge that some of you are going to have to face, and you're going to have to answer the question. I guess the way to approach this, the way I would begin to unravel this, is I'd want to ask the question, what exactly would be the problem with having my child, let's just say Eva or Annabeth, 6-year-old, 9-year-old, my girls, what would be the problem of having them visit a child who is a friend of theirs, but who is the child being raised by a homosexual couple, all right? Now, I'm not saying there would be no problem. I am asking what would be the problem, and this is what question, it seems to me, has to be answered before you can know how to proceed here. What would be the problem? Now, I can imagine two immediately that might be enough of a problem that would result in me saying no to my children, no, you can't go and visit or be in that situation. And it has nothing to do with the child. My daughters at this stage are, shall we say, sexually naive. When there was some comment about a guy kissing a guy, my girls looked at me with astonishment and did one of these ew numbers. Like, ew, like, who would do that? Why would they do that? So I'm reasonably confident that they are naive about these things, and I am happy to let my little girls stay little girls as long as they're little girls, all right? I do not want them exposed to the kinds of things that they are not in a position to manage properly. I remember a little detail out of Corrie Ten Boom's hiding place. She would ride with her father on the train to the big city, where he would set his watch to the official clock there and then go back to their little town and set all of his clocks in his clock shop to that official time, and he'd do this on a weekly basis. And she'd travel with him. And she was reading in her own Bible, and she came across a phrase that was called sex sin. And she didn't know what that was. And so she asked her father. She said, "Papa, what is this? What does this mean? What is this sex sin?" And her father thought for a moment, and then he looked up on the rack above where they were sitting at his suitcase. And he said, "Corrie, can you get that suitcase down for me, please?" And Corrie said, "Oh, no, Papa, I can't do that. That's too heavy for me." And her father said, "You're right. That is too heavy for you. And so is this. So your papa is going to carry this until you're ready to carry it for yourself." That is a fabulous little anecdote. And it emboldens me to be strong and keep my children from becoming sexualized before their time. I don't want them thinking about these things. Let them stay children for as long as they are children. There will be a time for them to understand this. Now, with that in mind, with that in place, how does that relate to this question about allowing your child to visit the home of a child being raised by a homosexual couple? What is my daughter going to think when she walks into this home and she sees that it's not a mother and a father that are raising this child, but it's a mother and a mother, or a father and a father? And how are they comporting themselves with each other? What is she going to think? She's going to think that this is odd. And then what is she going to do? Possibly ask me, "Papa, what is this?" And that's when I'm going to have to say, "Papa's going to have to carry this for you until you're ready to carry it. But don't you think it would be much better for me not to even have to address that? Isn't that a way of keeping them from carrying it by not exposing it to them to the kinds of things that they would raise questions regarding?" I think so. I don't need that grief. This isn't an act of hostility towards the child being raised by a homosexual couple, but I can see how I might not want to put my own child in a situation where they're wondering what the heck is going on, and therefore be exposed at an inappropriate age before they're ready to something that I'd rather not have them be exposed to. All right, so that's one reason. Now, that may be adequate, and I'm thinking right now, with both of my daughters, that's enough reason for me just to say no to that circumstance. There's another reason, too. And let's just say that this isn't reason number one doesn't apply. The other reason it might be a problem is it's part of the reason that I don't like TV, because what TV does is depicts circumstances that are morally inappropriate as if they're just swell. And this is a whole range of different things, not just sexual things, but of course sexual things. There are all kinds of shows that you watch which don't just champion homosexuality as beautiful and normal. And in this regard, they lie because they don't tell the story accurately. But also as premarital sex, as beautiful and normal. Is there a new TV show on called Mary the Virgin? Did I see a big poster down by LAX about that? Down where you... like, is that like this is a, I don't know. All I know about TV shows is the posters, and it's something like this is the crazy girl who's a virgin. That's what the TV show is about. I don't know. Maybe I'm misunderstanding it. Because virginity is like bizarre for TV land. Is that the message I want my girls to get? No. So if they go to this home where the child is a child being raised by a homosexual couple and everything looks normal at first, is this kind of communicating that this is a legitimate option? This is kind of okay. There are variations to this marriage thing, and this is just one of them. Mommy and Papa are male and female, and that's our deal. But here's another mom and dad who aren't. They're, I should say, here are parents that aren't mom and dad. They're dad and dad, or they're mom and mom. And, well, implicitly, is it possible she might get the sense that, I know it's weird to us, but that's okay for them? So we get give a relativistic message. Anyway, that's my concern. And what would be the problem? There's two of them. Now, maybe I'm overstating it. I'm not sure. Maybe I'm not. But we're going to have to face this before long. And frankly, I would rather err on the side of be careful when it comes to my daughters. And I suspect when it comes to your children, you'd want to do that too. Not that there's animosity in your heart towards a homosexual couple or the child. Not that you're trying to be judgmental, harsh, mean, unloving, intolerant. None of that is even on the table. This is not about that. This is about your children and what they're exposed to and what that ends up meaning to them. And if you are trying to instill a certain view of reality that you are convinced is true, that is the biblical view of reality, then the more help we can get in doing that, the better. And all the ways that our culture works against to tear that down, we should be avoiding. And maybe this is one of them. Anyway, just a thought. Thank you for joining me today. Enjoyed my time with you. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven this week. Okay, friends? Bye-bye.
Listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.